The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet that the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Pennsylvania State Representative Scott Conklin going to stop by, talk about the whole, this whole reframing that the media seems to be wanting to pull on us, trying to explain that, you know what, that whole conservative wave, you know, that insanity that's going on in places like Wisconsin and Ohio and Maine. It just passed us by. It just went right by Pennsylvania. You know, we didn't have any of the craziness that you saw. Our politicians, they're moderate. Our Republicans are pragmatic. If you believe that, I've got a couple of not crumbling bridges. I've got some pristine bridges for sale. Because the reality is, look, they want to privatize our schools, they want to privatize the liquor stores, they want to privatize the turnpike, they want to privatize the Port Authority in Pittsburgh. In fact, they already did part of it. They want to hand out these insane vouchers, they want to keep giving tax breaks to corporations, they want to cut $1 billion from education. I'm sorry, did I miss something? The radicalization is there, it's just that our media is not covering it. At least not the way that I think so. So today there was a big rally on the steps, and Kevin Mahoney, a Kutztown University professor, is going to be here talking about that. The big rally, you know, 1,000 people came out to voice their support. I'm waiting to see what the media says tomorrow. Oh, there were 20 people who showed up. Fox News says one guy was there with a sign. At some point, folks, you got to take back the house. And I'm hoping that this summer when those kids go home, and we're going to talk about this with Kevin Mahoney, I'm hoping when the finals are done, the books are put away for the summer, those college kids who go home, and trust me, there are going to be no jobs waiting for them. When they go home, they grab a sleeping bag, they grab a toothbrush, and they come right here to Harrisburg, and they camp out on the steps, they camp out in the rotunda, and say, you know what, we're not leaving until our future is secure. Also on the program tonight, David Bacon, author, photojournalist. We're going to talk about immigration and the things that have happened since the passage of NAFTA. He does some outstanding work. He's written 3 books on the topic and does some amazing photographs. I highly suggest taking a look at his stuff. And also Zed Jelani from Think Progress, going to talk about the Ayn Rand movie and the really pathetic showing. I think they really thought they could throw a couple of bucks into a bad movie and all the T-twits would go out and see it. Personally, I think it's way over their head, but, you know, hasn't brought in the money. And also, we're going to talk about Vermont's single payer with Zed Jelani, passed today. So good stuff. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So today we had the big rally. Yesterday was the grand bake sale where we were going to raise money to fund education through a bake sale, sell some cookies and, you know, 4.5 billion cookies to fill the budget. Didn't happen yesterday, but we'll see. I'm under the impression that folks are going to keep baking, and maybe they'll come back with some more card tables. There were about 30 people here yesterday, which is a good turnout. But still, hopefully when they come back, there will be more and more pressure. Because the reality is, you look at what happened today in history. Today in 1954, the Salk polio vaccine went into field trials. 1.8 million children were the initial trial. Started in Virginia with an elementary school there. Also used for the very first time the now standard double-blind testing method. You know, that's where the patient doesn't know, the doctor doesn't know if what you're getting is the actual stuff or it's a placebo. So they could figure out what worked, what didn't. A little over a year later, they said, you know, this is safe and we're going to move full head of steam with it. And it has wiped out polio in the Western Hemisphere. My kids don't have to worry about that. And the reason I bring that up is, A, it's important. Because it shows what we can do when we put our minds to something. This was a killer. We had a president who had it, which I think really gave it the push that it needed to get the funding and the emphasis behind it. But it was killing people. Thousands and thousands of people. And at the time they said, you know what, we gotta eradicate this. As a nation, we're gonna take this on, we're gonna beat this. And they invested in it. And they said, we're gonna do this, and they did it. That was a very can-do spirit, a very can-do attitude, and I wonder, when I look across this country, I look at the state here, the Commonwealth, talking about cutting $1 billion from education, talking about cutting higher education 56%, and it's not just here, it's Ohio, it's Wisconsin, it's Michigan, it's New Hampshire, it's all of these states who are talking about slashing education funding. This scorched earth Republican policy that they keep trying to ram down our throat. And I see this not investing in the future. This is not going to help us become energy independent. This is not going to help us continue to prosper as a nation. This is going to harm us. And yet I keep seeing polls that are 50-50 right down the middle. Well, so half the people are for Ryan's budget, half the people are against it. Because, like it's some kind of team sport thing. Today's rally brought 1,000 people out of their homes to come to the Capitol and say, you know what, to me and my family, education is important. And the stories that you heard from the speakers are, look, this is my shot to move up. This is my shot to live the American dream. This is my opportunity to lead a better life than my parents. This is the opportunity of the nation to move forward and to grow big brains. But we're failing. We're failing to invest on so many levels for short-term political gain, for short-term gratification. You know, the idea that they keep selling us this ridiculous notion that the only thing we can possibly do is cut spending. That's all we can possibly do, and cut taxes at the same time. So we're going to cut spending by the exact amount that we cut spending. So where's the savings to our deficit? Where's the savings to our debt? Well, there is none. This is just stealing more. This is just pocketing more. This is just more for the people who already have more. You look at Ohio. Ohio is taking $1.4 billion and handing it out to corporations in the hopes that maybe, possibly, oh, please, come and build on these facilities that we've created. Highly speculative. Building industrial parks that nobody wants in the hopes that maybe we're going to find somebody that we can steal from another state. Like, you know, maybe there's a manufacturer in Indiana left who wants a big subsidy. So we're going to take the $1 billion from education. We're going to take a whole bunch of money from higher education. We're going to put together a pot of $1.4 billion, and we're going to dish it out with a private interest doing the dishing out. So we're going to hand out this money like candy at Halloween. Here you go, campaign donors. Thank you. Here you go, American Greetings. Here's almost $100 million. Just move from Brooklyn, Ohio, to another suburb about 5 miles away so you can fleece them for millions of dollars in subsidies as well. And this skyrocketing gas prices. You know why we're having skyrocketing gas prices? Again, for the people in the cheap seats? Because we've got idiots running this country. We've got absolute idiots running this country who for one blind ideological reason or another have chosen not to look beyond the tips of their nose and look down the road to say, you know what? When I drove to work today, it took me an hour to get 15 minutes. maybe, just maybe, it would be a good idea if we put in a train or we invested in public transportation. Maybe, just maybe. But they're not going to do it because it's going to take some risk. It's going to take some investment. It's going to take some vision, some foresight. And we just don't have people who think that way anymore. What we have is people who all they care about is getting themselves reelected. It's about the next political point that they can score. It's about the next gotcha that they can get. It's no longer about representing us. Look, I'm no great lover of government. I find most of the folks not very worthy. But somehow they won the popularity contest. They're the ones holding the mantle. But when it comes down to it, when between the choice between a government of, for, and by we the people, where the representatives have to stand before us every couple of years and say, here's what I've done. Judge me on my record. Hopefully we have an informed, active, literate populace who goes, okay, well, I liked it or I didn't like it and you're out, whatever. As opposed to a private, for-profit, behind closed doors, no accountability corporation, whose only goal is to extract as much profit, as much resource as they possibly can, and then shell it out to a handful of very wealthy people. Those are your options. And, you know, I look at these T-Twizzlers who go, well, you know, I want liberty. I want government off my back. And I want to replace it by a huge multinational corporation. Because those are your options. There is no third option. Either you're going to have a government with an active populace who keeps them in check, or you're going to have a corporation. And quickly, for the last 30 years that... The last 30 years, we have been moving down that path towards fascism. And people get all riled up when they hear the F word. Oh, he said the F word. Oh, it's the F word. All it is the bundling of corporate and government entities together so that you can't distinguish between what is government and what is corporate. So what we see over here on the Hill by the pragmatic, middle-of-the-road, happy-go-lucky, you know, decent Republicans here are more calls for public-private partnerships, more melding of government and corporations. I mean, because that's how they're going to fund our transportation structure, by asking corporations to sponsor it, to bring in more corporate donors and more tolls. Maybe even private toll roads. Stop and think about how scary that is, where you don't even own your roads anymore. Some company in Spain does. And we talk about how much we need to be independent. We need to be energy independent. We need to be strong at home. Yet we're selling off all of our assets. And we're doing it at rock bottom prices. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. That much more, lots to get to. I've got some funny stuff. Pat Robertson back in the news. Alan West, can't wait to get to that. You got to stick around for that. But hopefully when we come back from the break down the road, hopefully Scott Conklin will be here to talk about this whole thing with the Republicans, kind of claiming we're not crazy like the Lulus in other states. We're moderate. We're pragmatic. We're okay. We're decent. We're back after this.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Public opinion is strongly against cutting Medicare. A Washington Post ABC poll shows 78% of Americans are against cutting it to reduce the national debt. The Republican House budget would end Medicare as we know it, including creating fixed vouchers to force seniors to buy private insurance instead. 65% of the American people are against doing that. This is massive opposition to a key element of the Republican budget plan, reminiscent of the massive opposition George W. Bush ran into when he tried to privatize Social Security. Republicans got a first-hand taste of that intense opposition to gutting Medicare while they were back in their congressional districts for the Easter recess. Paul Ryan was booed at a town hall meeting, and in event after event, many other Republicans also faced hostile voters angry about the plan attacking Medicare. Southern California grocery workers have authorized a strike as talks continue to try to avert that outcome. Jesse Russell reports.
A substantial number of grocery workers in Southern California voted in favor of strike action last week. The workers are represented by United Food and Commercial Workers Local 770, and they are currently in negotiations with a number of grocery chains in the region. The workers and chains have been negotiating since February, and the union has said the strike vote was simply a precautionary measure, as neither side wants to see talks devolve into either a walkout or a lockout. The same region currently in negotiations saw a historic strike and lockout in 2003, which lasted for 4 months. The stalemate was painful for both workers and the chains.
Workers for a Honeywell uranium conversion facility in Metropolis, Illinois, have been locked out of that plant for 10 months. The workers are represented by the United Steelworkers, who took the struggle of the 228 Illinois workers to the Honeywell shareholders meeting in Morristown, New Jersey, yesterday. Jeremy Long is with USW Local 7669.
What we're dealing with is the union's not wanting to accept what the company's offering. And what the company's offering is they want to do away with jobs by contracting them out, plus they want to do it with your seniority rights. You know, the health care, we've done settled on the health care and the wages. The union's done said that we're okay with increasing our wages.
They've been locked out since June 28th of 2010, with the most recent negotiating session being held April 20th. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals, and by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Ship Builders, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And again, I go back to this. I go back to this Pittsburgh Tribune Review article with the headline: "Conservative Wave Seems to Miss Pennsylvania," and this whole frame that, you know, the conservatives in Pennsylvania are more pragmatic. They're more moderate than in places like Ohio or Wisconsin. They're not crazy like those people. They're not radical. Yet here, I keep seeing the bills popping up. The no rights at work agenda that Metcalf keeps pushing, the voucher thing that's still out there to privatize education, privatizing part of the Port Authority in Allegheny County, privatizing the state wine and spirits shops, all of this stuff that seems pretty crazy to me, seems pretty extreme to me, not very pragmatic, not very moderate. But somehow, according to our media, everything's fine. Everything's fine. Go back to sleep. American Idol and Cheetos. Go on, go back. Just not happening. That's why I've asked Scott Conklin, Pennsylvania State Representative, to come talk to us a little bit about what's going on up in the Hill. Scott, I appreciate the time, brother.
Hey, not a problem, Rick. Just give me a second. I've got to put down my Cheetos, and I'm looking for American Idol on TV, but I'll find it.
Well, I mean, that's what they're telling us, that the Republican Party here in Pennsylvania somehow is more pragmatic, more moderate, and the article goes into great detail, you know, on how they're not as extreme, but they keep pointing out that, you know, Corbett dumped 42,000 people off of adult basic. They're going after all of these things, but remember, you know, this whole conservative wave just missed us.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the adult basic, the $833 million in tax credits to the wealthy this year, the gas companies are already charging folks in Pennsylvania a severance fee, but we don't collect it. We allow them to keep it. This is nothing more than hearsay. This is just strictly a misunderstanding by those of us who want an equal taxation and a fair workplace are just overreaching our bounds right now. I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek if anybody's recording.
Yeah, I'm taking it that way. But at the end of the day, I do believe it's going to take folks like today, the 1,000 or so college kids that came out to the Capitol, to protest the fact that this governor is stealing their future.
Rick, what scares me even worse is that, you know, without the Penguin, you don't need Batman. Without the Joker, you don't need a superhero.
Yep.
And what scares me, what I can see going on right now, is that the governor put this budget out. He says, we're cutting, you know, the stimulus is gone. The $650 million stimulus is gone, so we're going to cut education $1.2 billion because the stimulus is gone. That doesn't make sense. There's still $560 million worth of money he's cutting. You can slice it any way you want it, but at the end of the day, that's still $560 million. But what they did say is we've kept folks in DPW welfare where they're at. But now, if you want to fund education and you want to fund Penn State and Temple and Lincoln and our state and the state related, now you've got to take it away from welfare. So now you have the same people that are cutting it are going to want to ride in on their white horse and say, look, we saved you. We didn't cut 50%. We're only cutting 25%. It doesn't work that way. But what scares me is that they might get away with it.
Yeah, I mean, what they're doing is they're pitting granny against my infant.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're setting it up in such a way that when they do cut 25%, they're going to expect you to thank them.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Yeah. You know, the problem is now, I'm one of the guys that never joined a fraternity because every time you try to spank me, I don't ask for another one. I have a tendency to turn around and give you what you gave me back.
That's me in a nutshell. I was rushed one time for one day, and it didn't turn out well for either of us. But, you know, at the end of this, you know, when you're looking at this budget and the governor's going around trying to sell it, you're putting lipstick all over this pig. There are some people who are saying, well, you know, we got to take the tough medicine. We've got to, you know, times are tough. We got to sacrifice. And I'm not against shared sacrifice. I'm just not seeing the shared. I'm sacrificing. You know, our families are struggling. I'm not seeing the sharing.
Well, what they're able to do is they were able to say the Rick Smith and the Scott Conklin, all they want to do is raise taxes. And I say, no. What I want is tax fairness. I don't think it's right for someone making $50,000 a year trying to put four kids through school or two kids through college has to pay the brunt of it while billionaires either don't have to pay taxes in Pennsylvania or they get $833 million worth of cuts or they don't have to pay the sales tax because they're able to keep the 1% of it. Or they say, we hire people in Pennsylvania. But, you know, there's two things folks have to remember. Where your paycheck's made out, that if Rick Smith's paycheck's made out in Harrisburg, and even though the company's out of Harrisburg, although you might work in Philadelphia, your paycheck still comes out of Harrisburg. So you pay Harrisburg taxes, Pennsylvania taxes, even if you're working in New Jersey. These folks that are coming in are good people, but they're out of Texas. They're out of other states. They're coming in here and working, but they're paying their taxes back home. They say that they're running motel rooms, so there's the motel tax. The motel tax, once you stay after 30 days, there is no motel tax any longer. So all I'm saying is I don't think it's right for retired people, working people, to have to pay the brunt of taxes. All I'm asking for is that a fair share be put in place, that it's fair across the board, and not the total burden of the people that work in Pennsylvania, and that's where the problem lies.
Yeah, I'm right there. And look, I'm not against shared sacrifice. I mean, there are a number of things that we should do first and foremost. I think closing the Delaware loophole should be first on the list. Taxing the drillers, like every other state in the country, like even the one Tom Corbett seems to want to emulate, Texas, a huge, huge drilling tax. Those are the first two things on the list. When we accomplish those, then I'm going to talk about cuts.
Well, what's really interesting now is that you haven't heard much about these state stores since the Terzide plan that was going to raise $4 billion if we could only sell our liquor license for $2.1 million a piece. They figured out that no one's going to pay that kind of money for that. So now it's a moral issue.
Yeah.
It's no longer about a money issue.
It's core functions of government.
And when you and you and I have discussed this before, that when you look at the voucher plan that any way you cut, I don't care what plan they come up with. For instance, I'm from Penn State University, Central Pennsylvania. I neither have private schools nor do I have kids doing it. So the voucher plan, if they do put it through, is going to take money away from my local school district. And that's what it's so hard for people to understand. And we've talked about this. The voucher system strictly becomes a lottery. Those who are fortunate enough to get their kids in that, if they're in a bad school district, they get it. But 98% of those kids are still going to go to that same school. And the only difference is there's going to be money taken out of that school. So the folks that are living there are going to pay higher property taxes than what they did before. It doesn't add up. The numbers won't add up. But all they keep saying is they use the catchphrases. People need control of the schools. People need control of their futures. And it's hard for the average person to understand what a Delaware loophole is, what combined reporting is, what the 1% vendor discount is. People don't understand that, and that's why it's so easy for them to talk around it.
Well, I mean, I've always given the right credit. I've always given Republicans credit at being able to market, advertise, campaign, sloganeer, whatever you want to use. They're masters at linguistic manipulations. I think death tax was the greatest two words ever put together. I think it's BS, but I think it does what it was supposed to do, which is fool people.
Well, it comes back down to packaging. If I told Rick Smith, I said, you know, Rick, here's the deal. I'm going to give you $50 today, or if you're willing to wait 3 or 4 weeks, I'll give you $52. You're going to say, you know what? And if you're asked that question, you're going to say, I'm going to take the $50. But if I reword that question and I say, Rick, here's $52 that you're going to get next week. But you know what? I'm going to cheat you $2 and I'm going to give you $50. Do you want your $52? You're going to say, no, I'm getting cheated $2.
Yep.
It's all about the wording.
Yep.
If they would tell people, do you want a select few to get private school and your property taxes go up and your kids don't get to go to that private school? Most people would say, this is bull crap. I don't want it. But the way they do it, they say, we're going to empower you, the parent, that your kids are going to have choice. And people want to better their children's lives. So the poll question comes back, yes, people want vouchers. But if you would ask that question is, do you want your child put in a lottery system where only 2 out of 100 or 3 out of 100 will have the opportunity to go, but everybody else's property tax, you're going to go, people would look at you and say, this is the most ludicrous idea I've ever heard in my life.
Yep, it's like having the winning lottery ticket and nowhere to validate it.
This is strictly an attack on unions. I don't care whether you're a teacher. I don't care whether you're making $34,000 a year and working for PennDOT. I don't care if you're an AFSCME union and you're in the laundry at the local nursing home making $9 an hour. This is strictly an attack on unions. And that's what this comes down to. And contrary to what people say, they have passed 55 bills already. 55 bills. They debate on the floor. We can't even amend the bills. They use maneuvers, so there's no amendment process going. And the problem is, there's good people. It's not Republicans, it's not Democrats. It's about the power of a few
right.
that have been empowered to do what they want.
What happened to all of that transparency and accountability and that whole meritocracy that the right keeps talking about?
Well, the glossy brochure will be out again in another year, so you'll get to see it on that again.
You mean like the pledge? You know, the pledge that the Senate, the congressional Republicans put out? 48 pages, 27 of which are colored glossy pictures?
Absolutely. That's the most important thing. You know, we are visual people that get excited by visual objects. So if the picture shows a happy family with a happy couple with in good health, that's what we want in life.
Happy, smiling white people. Nothing wrong with that, I guess. if it gets you a vote. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Pennsylvania State Representative Scott Conklin. Scott, you know, one of the things that you brought up, this attack on unions, I happened to go to the press conference that one of your colleagues, and I'm sorry that I had to put it that way, Mr. Metcalf had, pushing his no rights at work agenda. I got to tell you, this guy scares me, and really the number of people who have signed on to this scares me. We couldn't possibly see Pennsylvania become the 23rd right to work for less state, which really, really is a scary prospect.
Rick, and it is a scare process, is that the unions don't make up much of the workforce today. It's only about 17%, but the problem is that 17% sits a bar that everybody has to abide by. So they actually don't just encompass that 70% of the work, they're encompassing 50 to 60% of the work, the workers out there, because to compete with what, you know, to compete with somebody getting a decent wage and benefits, when I say decent wage, you know, I'm talking folks making $35,000 a year and have benefits. That means to compete with that, not to lose your employee, you have to pay that, whether they're union or non-union. So everybody benefits from what that collective bargaining does at the end of the day. And it's hard to get folks to understand that. If you can get rid of that collective bargaining, you can bring the price, what you have to pay an employee, down. But it's short-sighted. As soon as people don't make money, the economy begins to fall in a nosedive, even worse than it is now. And it's hard to get people to understand that because it becomes such a complex issue. It's sort of like shutting down the government. America, for the first time, has had their bond rating decreased. And it's hard to explain to folks that bond ratings aren't based on the amount of money that a state or a government or a nation has. It's the amount of the ability to repay. So when you have ideologues out there saying, we're not going to raise the debt limit, which we have to get the deficit under control, but creditors look at that. If they're not going to raise the debt limit, they're going to forfeit on loans. And that's going to devalue the dollar,
right,
and it's going to lower their ability to borrow money. And that's what they've done in America today. They have been able to send this message to the worldwide market that we are willing not to increase our debt limit, and we're willing to default on bonds. And it's ludicrous. It's short-sighted, good one-liners, but at the end of the day, what's killing America today is ideological people who like one-liners rather than understanding that there is accountability done to what we're doing, and we're beginning to see it. And they're going to blame it on Obama, and they're going to blame it on the Democrats, when in reality it's done to an audit. And I know I'm going off track, and people are listening saying, what in the hell is this guy talking about? And what I'm trying to explain is that's exactly what's happening. For me to explain what's happening not in Washington and Harrisburg today, your eyes glaze over, and you say, well, I just want to hear the parents right and live within your means. And that's what's happening in America today, that it's easier to be an ideologue than it is to be a policy wonk, and guys like me are being paid for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to, with the simple-minded sloganeering, but the reality is, you brought up an interesting point with the debt limit. I do believe Republicans see this as a bargaining chip because they don't give a tinker's damn about this country. They have this scorched-earth policy that they pursue, without fail. They are willing to run this country off the cliff to get their little slice for their small handful of campaign donors. And they will use this debt ceiling to get what they want, which is to destroy Medicare.
And what's so funny about this is that there's a few people that get it, but most of those folks who are ideologues, I've listened to them and I've met them, they really believe what they're saying, and that's where the problem comes into play, is that they believe in what they're saying because the average person, when you tell them, you've got to live within your means, you can't borrow any money, and the deficit's killing us. Well, guess what? They're right on all three of those. They're absolutely correct. The deficit is killing us. You've got to live within your means, and there's no two ways about it. But the problem is that once you start explaining to people how we got to where we're at today, you know, and for this light of heart, it wasn't Barack Obama. It hit before he got here. I know it's more fun to call it the Barack Obama, you know, recession, but, you know, as powerful as our president is, he can't control the world market.
Right.
Before he got here. I mean, it goes back to taking Social Security and spending it to balance the budget, pet projects. All this needs to get under control. They've been pigs at the trough too long, and I'm a Democrat saying this. But you've got to correct the problem, and you've got to take precautions to do it. And these guys that want to stop the debt ceiling and want to do it honestly believe that's what's going to happen. But the problem is they aren't economics people. They don't understand governmental entities and how bonding issues work and how the dollar is devaluated and how we're the world currency. And if they screw around, we're going to have the euro as the world currency, which means you think oil is expensive now?
Yep.
You wait until the world currency, and oil's going up so much to us is because our bond rating just went down. That's one of the reasons this is happening today, because the uncertainty in Washington that we're going to have the ability to pay our bills. And again, I'm just going off on a rail, you know, track somewhere, but I love this country so much. It scares me, and I know I joke around, but it scares me to see what happens. And by the way, remember, the two downfalls of every great civilization, overextension of military forces and corruption within government itself, and you're seeing it both.
Yeah, and it is getting worse and worse on both fronts. And I don't look forward to this whole discussion, because I do believe that the Democrats, and I know you're a Democrat and a good Democrat at that, but I do believe they will cave and they will give in, and we will see the beginning of the end of Medicare, and I do believe part of Social Security as well, because Republicans see an opportunity and they never waste a good crisis.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're going to tell you the way to save Social Security is to privatize it. And please, anybody listening, don't allow that to happen. The way to save Social Security, go back to 1937 when it was implemented, when the cap was $90,000 that first people made, and put it in today's numbers and bring it up that the cap should be $250,000. And most people don't even realize that.
Yeah, I'm a fan of removing the cap, lowering it to about 3.5-4%, and sorry, that's just how it goes.
Yeah, and you'll fix it overnight. Yep. When it was put in, most people don't realize that. When Social Security put in, what you do, and my wife always reminds me, you have to tell them again, but when Social Security was created, it had a $90,000 cap. So people only paid Social Security up to $90,000. That's what it is today. We need to, if we uncap it and take it to $250,000, you will see Social Security become solvent overnight.
So
basically what happens is Rick Smith and Scott Conklin, we pay the full percentage, but someone making $300,000 a year only pays 2 or 3%
right.
of their pay-in. And that's one of the easy ways to fix it, but who gives the money, who gives the donation?
Yeah, that's why they pay the lobbyists.
That's exactly right.
Last question I've got for you before we wrap up. You know, the unemployment situation is, our governor called basically all the unemployed folks lazy, too lazy to go out and get jobs. There's a situation, a crisis, I guess, coming down the road. May 20th, we have to pass some kind of legislation to get unemployment extended so we get some federal dollars. What's going on around that?
We're still waiting for it to move. I mean, this, again, this isn't even Pennsylvania dollars. This is this ideological part that people don't want to work. And I don't know about the friends you have. You know, you can always find that 1 out of 1,000 that really doesn't want to work. But my friends, I grew up in construction. They still work construction. They can't afford to live on unemployment.
Nope.
They want to get back to work.
They need healthcare.
And if we don't take care of this, and again, it gets complicated for people to understand, but if we do not sign on to this and get these extensions for these folks, the unemployment extension are gone. Even here next month, the folks don't have it, and I don't know how they're going to feed their families, and how you're going to keep a strong economy going if people do not have money to spend.
And what happens to the economy when that money is pulled out of Pennsylvania? What happens to the small businesses here in the state?
You're going to see unemployment rise. You're going to see the small businesses struggling again. It'll be even worse than they were. It's all you talk about trickle down economics. That is trickle-down economics. Bottom-up economics, it stimulates the economy. Trickle-down economics, that is a trickle-down plan in reverse to what most people think it is.
Yep. I've been trickled on enough. Thanks so much. Scott Conklin, always great talking to you.
Sorry I got off on a tangent. Thank you so much as well.
Always a great conversation. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Hey, have a great night.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show. Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
One morning in March, Ohio's pious anti-spending governor, John Kasich, got up, brushed his teeth, and went to the Capitol to announce that he was slashing spending on schools, teachers, and other public employees. Gotta balance the budget, he lectured. The very next morning, Kasich got up, brushed his teeth, and went to an airport in Columbus, where he climbed aboard a state-owned King Air to fly him 144 miles to Cleveland to give a speech. His traveling entourage was so big that the governor's hop to Cleveland required 2 airplanes. Cost to taxpayers, $2,200 just for the short flight. Indeed, this small government champion turns out to be a fly-happy believer in socialized transportation. For him, In only his first 3 months in office, Kasich used government airplanes for 20 trips, far more than his predecessors. Then there are the little add-ons at taxpayer expense. For example, arriving at one airport in a rain, the governor noted that there were no umbrellas. No problem. His personal aide dashed off to a sporting goods outfit and came back with 20 of them, at a cost of $424. That's $21 each. What happened to competitive bidding? I can't get to all those places if I'm not able to fly, retorts the stern state budget slasher. Well, golly, Gov, no one's asking you to walk or even drive around your state, but five airlines have flights from Columbus to Cleveland. You're big on privatizing government services, so why not start with yourself by flying commercial? I only use a state plane when we have to use it, when I think the schedule demands it, the governor insists. Yeah, like on those essential trips you made to Canton and Cincinnati for press conferences to announce staff appointments. This is Jim Hightower saying, but then, budget cuts are for little people, not for Republican governors.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, I look at, you know, the things that we talked about with Scott Conklin, and a bright guy. I mean, just a good guy all the way around, in my opinion, what a Democrat should be. You know, a guy who's not afraid to stand up and stand his ground. You know, one of the things that I find amazing, and you look at somebody like Chris Christie in New Jersey, who working class blue collar folks look to and say, you know, he's got the right idea. He's, you know, he's a stand up guy. He's dead wrong on virtually everything he has done, but they see him as someone who stands his ground. He's somebody who's going to stand and fight even if he's wrong. And he is wrong, but again, it's this decisiveness that the working class people seem to be so enamored with. Well, Democrats tend to be more compromising. They're willing to say, okay, for the good of the country, I've got to give a little bit on my principles to allow something to move forward. We'll get a couple of good things. You'll get a couple of things that are going to be negative, but we're going to move forward. Republicans, in I guess there's some credit to be had in that they're willing to stand on their ideology, regardless of what it means for the country, regardless of what it means for families, for children. They're standing their principle. And, you know, Jake, I look at this and I say, you know, at some point, don't we as a society have to get those people out of government? I mean, those kind of simple minds just scare me to death.
I mean, let's be honest. I mean, this is the first time in my life I can remember either political party to be this ideological. When I was growing up, there were some Republicans that to this day I remember, and they were icons, but yet they were moderate, and they came to Congress with the idea of getting things done, and they worked hand in glove with the president, whoever he was, whichever party he was. They worked hand in glove with the Democrats and got things done. But now you have people who are so ideologically to the right that their chief aim is to win now and win at any cost. And that's dangerous to democracy, because the very definition of politics is the art of compromise. And when you're not willing to compromise, from their point of view, there can be nothing else but 100% victory.
Now, stop and think about this. In your lifetime, now, you know, you were a little kid at the time, but in your lifetime, we had a president who wrote to his brother and said, should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history. There is a tiny splinter group, he says, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are a few Texas oil millionaires and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their numbers are negligible, and they are stupid. And again, it's this great socialist president that we had, this great socialist Dwight David Eisenhower, who said that. If you were to abolish Social Security, unemployment, eliminate labor laws, you wouldn't be heard from again. You'd be ostracized. You'd be out on the island by yourself. Yet here we are, some 57 years later, and that is exactly what the party of Eisenhower wants to do. Abolish Social Security, get rid of unemployment, eliminate labor laws, so we can hand more to the folks who already have more.
You know, he has a reputation to, among some historians, of being kind of a caretaker. But the more you see of Ike Eisenhower, the more you respect him and appreciate what he did. Now, think when he came in. He came in at the beginning, the end of the Korean War, but from the end of the Korean War into 1960, there was this absolute explosion of the economy. And the things that he did were intrinsic in pushing that economy into that great explosion. You're talking about construction. You're talking about enhancing union membership. You're talking about doing everything he could to make sure that American industries prospered.
He built a highway system.
Yes, I mentioned that.
Socialist.
And that was
socialist.
That not only helped, you know, helped the burgeoning population, but it was a huge economic boom. And when you look back, Rick, I think he probably historically deserves more credit than he gets.
1-888-520 Rick, 1-888-520-7425. What do you think about this? Our good socialist president. Doing away with Social Security, unemployment, or labor laws. Stupid! We're back after this.
All right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make them happy.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
You're an enemy, but you know you're an American.
increasingly, you know, I'm looking at the enemy, and the enemy has turned into a political party. The radical right, to me, seems to be the enemy. They, this scorched earth policy that they seem to be pursuing, this idea that they can do whatever they want, and the Democrats will concede. And again, I hope the Democrats don't. But if you get two people who are standing at polar opposites, what happens to the country? And again, I don't think Republicans care. Just like I know this governor, for his blind political faith, is never going to raise taxes no matter what happens. Even if we have to cut $1 billion from education. Even if we have to steal the future from college kids. And this unemployment thing that's coming up. I mean, there aren't any jobs. The answer to this is creating some jobs, which means demand. And as I've been saying from day one, what we should have done is not given money to banks, not given money out, and here's a whole bunch of loans, or here's a whole bunch of tax breaks, or here we're going to build you an industrial park. What we should have done is said, you know what? We want to put solar panels on every single federal building. We're going to buy 5 million of them. Somebody make them. We're going to buy them. We're going to buy cars that get 40 miles to the gallon. Who's going to sell them? And you create demand. You let the free market, let private industry go wild at trying to fill that demand. That's what we should have been doing. Not handing out billions of dollars to big banks and to CEOs. No. And when we talk about getting unemployment to folks who need it because there are no jobs, well, we're dependent then. We're a dependent nation. And I look at the USA Today who said, you know what? Americans are more dependent than ever on government assistance. More dependent than we have been since 1929. We're dependent. In fact, 18.3, a record, 18.3 of the nation's total personal income was a payment from government. It was Social Security. It was Medicare. It was food stamps. It was unemployment. Those lazy people won't go to work, even though we know no jobs. Five applicants for every opening. That means four people were never going to get that job. You look at the fact that wages now account for the lowest share of income in the country's history, 51%, the lowest since 1929. And what they say at the USA Today is that the income data show how fragile and government-dependent the recovery is after the recession that officially ended in June of 2009. So understand, when we pull that plug and we say no more unemployment benefits for you people, when we pull that plug, this economy is going to collapse because we're propping it up with folks who have a little coin in their pocket. They're able to pay their mortgage. They're able to pay their rent. They're keeping up. They're just keeping going. What happens when you pull that safety net away? What happens when you pull that lifeline away? Well, what happens is we're going to have a collapse, which is exactly what the Republicans want. And they're gambling. They're gambling on the fact that they think you're going to buy into Ryan's budget. They think you're going to buy into slash and burn economics. They think you're going to buy into this. That somehow, you know, times are tough. We got to pull and tighten our belt. We're going to have to cut those old people off of Medicare and make that Social Security more elusive. You know, because times are tough. Even though we know Ryan's budget doesn't do anything. All it does is cause more pain for you and me. And, of course, more tax breaks for those at the very top. And don't take my word for it. Republicans want to destroy Medicare and Social Security. CBO just came out with a study here today. It was they said, you know, Ryan's plan, the Republican approved House bill that went through, is going to raise the age of eligibility for seniors for Medicare. It's going to happen, according to the CBO. Currently, it's at 65. They say in a number of years, it's going to go up to 67. Because it increases 2 months every year, starting in 2022. So eventually we're going to get down that road where the Republicans want it, where you're older. What happens to those folks who now can't get insurance? What happens to that 55, 56, 57-year-old who's struggling to make it to 65? What happens to those folks? What happens when you get to 65? You go, oh, sorry, 67. You know, we talked about this the other night. You know, in the UK, their life expectancy is right around where ours is. Why? Because they're moving towards an unequal society as well, just like us. Yeah, they've got a number of people who are over 100 years old, just like we've got. We've got supposedly a boom of 100-year-plus people. Why? Because they had the assets, the medical care, to make it that long. And again, you know, as we move down this road, folks, they're going to destroy these programs. And it's going to happen, Jake. They are going to destroy these programs, and it's going to be the debt that they use, the debt ceiling that they use to get us there.
Well, I don't know if you've been on top of it, but from what I've seen, I mean, these Republicans are just being excoriated when they go back to their home district. Many of them never intimated at all that they would be in favor of even considering privatizing Social Security or Medicare. And they're going back, and these seniors are waiting for them, and they're saying, hey, look, there's no way we're going to stand back and allow you to do this to us. And some of them are backing up and saying, you know, they're using the phrase, well, you know, it's just a blueprint. It's just a blueprint. Well, it's not a blueprint. It's a real plan that they have every intention of following through if they can. But I do believe they've bit off more than they can chew in this issue. Surveys I saw, plus polls, I believe it was about 78% of the American people don't want you to touch Medicare. It is indeed still.
And even
Social
the caveat.
Security net is the third rail. Absolutely.
Even the caveat that they keep throwing out there, which is, if you're over 55, it's not going to touch you. Don't worry about it. Over 55, it's not going to come anywhere near you. You're fine. And what I find interesting is you got John Boehner, the Speaker of the House. Saying that, you know what, the House may refuse to even have a vote on raising the debt limit unless, you know, those Democrats are willing to, you know, look at getting rid of Medicare, you know, doing some things with Medicare. He said, quote, he told Politico, quote, if the president doesn't get serious about the need to address our fiscal nightmare, yeah, there's a chance it, the debt limit, of course, could not happen. But that's not my goal, he said. I think it's time to deal with entitlement programs on the debt ceiling. So basically saying, you know, look, we're going to hold this, we're going to hold you hostage. And if you don't do what we want you to do, we're going to crash this economy. And you're the president, and it's going to come down on your back. They're going to blame you. Which is what they've wanted from the beginning. They've wanted the president to fail from the beginning. You know, Limbaugh said it from the beginning. You know,
I know what his plans are, as he has stated them. I don't want them to succeed.
Yeah, I don't know how much more clear you can be. I want him to fail was the message that we heard. You know, how much clearer can you be when someone comes out and says, I want him to fail? I just don't get it. And what you've got is you've got people who, hey, I want him to fail too. Hey, ding dong. If he fails, we all fail. We all suffer. The global citizens, the multinational citizens, they just could go somewhere else. They've got the resources to up and go. You know, we keep talking about the French Revolution where people storm the gates and off with their heads. If you can find them, they'll just do like corporations have been doing for the last 30 years, jumping from one exploitable place to the next. It's you and I who are stuck here. It's you and I who have to clean up their messes. It's you and me, man. We're the ones who are in this. Anyway, the Republicans have, you know, again, the propaganda machine, they are in full tilt. They've come out with this new movie, this Ayn Rand movie. When we come back, I want to talk about a little bit about this Atlas Shrugged Part 1. What a flop. We're back after this.
Defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Public opinion is strongly against cutting Medicare. A Washington Post ABC poll shows 78% of Americans are against cutting it to reduce the national debt. The Republican House budget would end Medicare as we know it, including creating fixed vouchers to force seniors to buy private insurance instead. 65% of the American people are against doing that. This is massive opposition to a key element of the Republican budget plan, reminiscent of the massive opposition George W. Bush ran into when he tried to privatize Social Security. Republicans got a first-hand taste of that intense opposition to gutting Medicare while they were back in their congressional districts for the Easter recess. Paul Ryan was booed at a town hall meeting, and in event after event, many other Republicans also faced hostile voters angry about the plan attacking Medicare. Southern California grocery workers have authorized a strike as talks continue to try to avert that outcome. Jesse Russell reports.
A substantial number of grocery workers in Southern California voted in favor of strike action last week. The workers are represented by United Food and Commercial Workers Local 770, and they are currently in negotiations with a number of grocery chains in the region. The workers and chains have been negotiating since February, and the union has said the strike vote was simply a precautionary measure, as neither side wants to see talks devolve into either a walkout or a lockout. The same region currently in negotiations saw a historic strike and lockout in 2003, which lasted for 4 months. The stalemate was painful for both workers and the chains.
Workers for a Honeywell uranium conversion facility in Metropolis, Illinois have been locked out of that plant for 10 months. The workers are represented by the United Steelworkers, who took the struggle of the 228 Illinois workers to the Honeywell shareholders meeting in Morristown, New Jersey yesterday. Jeremy Long is with USW Local 7669.
What we're dealing with is the union's not wanting to accept what the company's offering. And what the company's offering is they're wanting to do away with jobs by contracting them out, plus they want to do it with your seniority rights. You know, the health care, we've done settled on the health care and the wages. The union's done said that we're okay with increasing our wages.
They've been locked out since June 28th of 2010, with the most recent negotiating session being held April 20th. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals, and by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Ship Builders, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared.
I haven't done that in a while. I did shake one's hand once. I'm kidding. No, I mean, look, at the end of the day, we're all citizens of this country. Just some of us have some bizarre ideas. And you look at the amount of money that's spent into changing folks' ideas. And I look at this movie, Atlas Shrugged, Part 1. Like there's going to be a trilogy or something. I guess that was the grand plan, but the fact of the matter is, in almost 300 theaters, it grossed somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.7 million, which I guess is pretty pathetic by industry standards, especially when you spent more than $10 million to put it together. I guess if you got that kind of money to throw around, why not? It puts your message out there. Good propaganda. So here to talk a little bit about the movie, because I haven't seen it, Zed Jelani. He's with Think Progress. Thinkprogress.org is the website. Zed, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ray.
Tell me about this Ayn Rand movie. I mean, this was pretty much the conservative wet dream. This was their propaganda piece. I think they thought the T-Twizzlers were all going to come out and support it. Really hasn't happened.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. If you look at Ayn Rand, I mean, for those of your listeners who may have never heard of her, she was an author that wrote prolifically, especially in the mid-20th century. She was originally Russian, but her family fled Russia after the Soviet Union started, after the Russian Revolution. And she basically, from that experience, she became basically the opposite of like a totalitarian communist. She became a complete, a very, very strict free market ideological capitalist, you know, and not only a capitalist, but someone who wrote prolifically about the virtues of selfishness. That's what she called it. She said that altruism you know, isn't only something that's undesirable, but it's something that's evil, is what she used to say. And she basically, she tried to mold a philosophy called objectivism, basically saying that greed is good. And, you know, decades after her death, they finally put together a movie. They've been trying for years to make a movie about one of her novels, Atlas Shrugged. And it finally came out, and I actually had a chance to see it, you know, given that I'm someone who's probably as far away from an objectivist as possible. I went and watched it, and, you know, it was a sight to behold, you know, to see this movie representing this philosophy that a lot of major Republicans and a lot of major conservatives have always worshipped. And to basically see it flop at the box office, I guess that means that the movie must not be valid, because according to them, if you're not striking lucky in the free market, you're not worth anything.
Yeah, I mean, excellent point. And the reality is I got to be honest, I wouldn't pay to see it. Maybe if somebody sent me a copy of it, I might watch it. But the reality is I'm not giving them any money, because this is what it is. It is the piece of propaganda that perpetrates their belief structure. That pushes people in the direction of this bizarre theology, I think.
You know, and that's exactly right. I mean, basically what she did, and I haven't read Atlas Shrugged, but I have read another one of her novels, Anthem. And basically what she does with her books is she does something which we really don't need. If you look at the world around us, we really don't need any more justification for selfishness.
Right.
I think we have more than enough people in the world right now acting selfishly, but basically what she tried to do was use these parables to basically talk, to lavish praise on people, on characters who behave selfishly, and to attack people who think about others, who think altruistically. Basically, it's an attack on the moral principles that have guided pretty much every civilization for thousands of years, which is basically based on the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You know, you are your brother's keeper, and it takes a village to raise a society and raise a community. And, you know, particularly with Atlas Shrugged, you know, I watched the movie, and it's interesting, you know, I'm certainly not someone who agrees with the philosophy, but I actually didn't think it was as bad as some of the critics said. It was definitely not a good movie, but, you know, I was able to sit through it. And basically what you see in that movie, and not to spoil too much, but what you see in that movie is characters who are railroad tycoons, steel tycoons, head captains of industry, the heads of the biggest corporations in America. Basically, it portrays them as oppressed people. I mean, these are people who are spending their days and nights in, you know, in ballrooms and nightclubs and the fanciest, you know, skyrise apartments. And all they're doing the entire movie is complaining about being oppressed because they have some regulations for the government and they have to pay their workers a certain wage for them to live, and they have to pay some taxes. And it really feels absurd. It really, really feels absurd.
Did you see any regular people in the movie? I mean, were there working people in the movie that you could go, oh, well, they're actually worse off than the people that are so oppressed?
That's what's so bizarre about this. And that's actually probably part of the reason I liked it I didn't like it as a movie, but part of the reason I was able to tolerate it as a movie, because the imagery is so fancy and it's just so modernist. You know, the entire thing is set in gigantic ballrooms. In skyrise apartments and huge office buildings and very modern architecture. Everyone's wearing tuxedos, and they're talking about being oppressed. I mean, I think the only time you ever saw any ordinary folks in the movie was they showed some newsreels of some workers protesting at the beginning, you know, suggesting that the workers are not being productive and they're protesting and they're being lazy and not adding anything to society. And I believe one other point in the movie when they talk about a factory that went out of business because they paid their workers too much, which, by the way, I don't know if that's ever happened in history, but it does happen in the world of this movie.
Well, when you're making up your own movie and you're writing your own script, anything's possible. The reason I ask if there were any regular people in there, because, you know, I know a lot of Tea Party people who are just blue collar working class folks who really they look at what's happened to the country and everything that they were sold didn't turn out to be right. Their 401ks are gone. They were told they were going to be millionaires. They were told if they work hard and did what they were supposed to, they'd get ahead. They're struggling right now. I understand the anger. So when you look at a movie like this and they can see no one in it like themselves, I don't think it's a surprise that nobody showed up.
No, I think that's very true. I think a lot of conservatives have heard the Ayn Rand name, have heard about Atlas Shrugged and Anthem and Fountainhead, about her writings, and they think, well, you know, that's the thing for me. She's just talking about how government, you know, stifles business and how free enterprise is good. But that's really not the totality of her message. The totality of her message is that selfishness is the highest moral virtue, that people who act altruistically and think about others are behaving immorally, and that the rich people literally are the highest moral order of society. Those are the people that we should worship and aspire to. It's way beyond mainstream conservatism. And I think what's really interesting is that Think Progress actually put together a video of a lot of major Republicans praising Ayn Rand. I mean, Paul Ryan, who just put together this awful budget that, you know, effectively privatizes and ends Medicare, that slashes our education and social spending, that continues to cut taxes on the rich people. Paul Ryan said that one of the major reasons he got into politics is because he was inspired by Ayn Rand. This is a woman who, you know, savagely attacks poor people, middle-class people, who says that the only moral order in society is to be selfish and to make money. And that's literally what she says. I'm not exaggerating.
No,
and
no.
This is the man,
I've seen
Paul Ryan. He did this.
And the interesting thing about Paul Ryan, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, as a kid after his father passed away, much like after my mother passed away, the both of us did collect Social Security insurance based until we were 18.
No, I mean, that's very true. I mean, if it wasn't for the welfare state and for the social safety net that we built up in this country, that every modern country, successful country, has built up, he wouldn't be around today. He certainly wouldn't be a successful congressman on all the network news, you know, leading the debate if he didn't have that safety net. And, you know, this was possibly before he got to Ayn Rand. He got into politics a little later than that in life. And what I like to say is, if you're between the ages of 16 and 24 and you like Ayn Rand, you know, I can give you a pass. But if you grow older than that and you're still obsessed with this philosophy, you have a problem. You have an issue. You have not intellectually matured past the point of trying to justify selfishness.
Excellent, excellent point. The last question on the movie before we move along. Did you see Red Scorpion, the Jack Abramoff movie with Dolph Lundgren? Did you see that?
You know, I haven't gotten a chance to see that.
See, I was going
to
ask you if it was any better than that, because it was a horrible movie. Don't bother wasting your time.
Okay.
but I just wanted to see if it was any better. The other question I did have for you, you wrote a nice piece over at Think Progress about Vermont passing the single-payer health care system, virtually becoming the first state in the country to make health care a right. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, we had the recent health care reform, and it disappointed a lot of people, and I think rightly, because it basically still left things in control of the private insurance industry. I think it made things a lot more humane and expanded health access, which is good, but it didn't really break up the private health insurance industry's stranglehold over our system. So what they're doing in Vermont is they're basically trying to design something similar to a single-payer system. Basically what that means is you have one insurer, a public system, something like Medicare, covering everyone. And that's actually a lot cheaper to cover people that way than with private insurers, because you cut out that profit-making. You cut out the bureaucracy of having doctors having to deal with hundreds of insurance companies, having to deal with the health insurance bureaucracy, which is basically designed to turn you away to make a buck. And it actually can be administered a lot cheaper, save the state a lot of money. The Vermont House passed this legislation last month. The Vermont Senate passed it this month. And the governor, you know, actually ran on single payer, and he plans to sign it into law. Now, there is one complication. In order to consolidate everyone into that public insurer in Vermont, they have to get some waivers from the federal health care law. And right now, those waivers will not be issued until 2017. So right now, the Vermont congressional delegation and the governor is lobbying the federal government to try to get that waiver date moved up to 2014 so that they can get single payer up running in 3 years rather than, you know, out in 2017.
Well, I mean, they've been giving it some other waivers. This would be a good waiver to give.
No, absolutely. And you know, some people, you know, I've heard some people think that, you know, it's a bad idea for states to go their own way. We just had the federal health care reform. We should try that out first. But, you know, what I've said is that I think states have always led the way on certain things. I think Vermont's led the way on a lot of things. I think California's led the way on a lot of things. California's actually passed single payer twice, but it was vetoed by the previous governor. And we await to see what happens with the current governor, with Jerry Brown. And I think, you know, if we can't get the votes together on the federal level yet, let's get some people into a decent, humane style of healthcare, the same that we give our senior citizens with Medicare, very similar to that. Let's get that running in some states first and, you know, let them lead the way.
Yeah, and, you know, maybe if you get it running right and the costs come down, it's going to be an attractor of business, because you don't want to pay high premiums either.
No. I mean, people, especially right-wingers, talk so much, oh, auto workers pay too much, these auto companies are getting too much in healthcare costs. Well, you know, the primary reason for that is that they see Canada as an attractive place. I mean, where are Ford and GM running? They're running a couple hundred miles up the border up to Canada because they don't have to deal with healthcare costs. So I think absolutely business should be on board this. Ordinary people should be on board this. You know, the only people I think that should really have an economic interest against this are the big insurance companies, some of the more conservative doctor lobbies, and, the drug companies that don't want to have to deal with a powerful negotiator like Medicare.
Yep, and the profiteers, the people who profit off of the current system. Zed Jelani, Think Progress. ThinkProgress.org is the website. I appreciate your time. Great work you guys do over there.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
One morning in March, Ohio's pious anti-spending governor, John Kasich, got up, brushed his teeth, and went to the Capitol to announce that he was slashing spending on schools, teachers, and other public employees. Gotta balance the budget, he lectured. The very next morning, Kasich got up, brushed his teeth, and went to an airport in Columbus, where he climbed aboard a state-owned King Air to fly him 144 miles to Cleveland to give a speech. His traveling entourage was so big that the governor's hop to Cleveland required two airplanes. Cost to taxpayers, $2,200 just for the short flight. Indeed, this small government champion turns out to be a fly-happy believer in socialized transportation. For him. In only his first 3 months in office, Kasich used government airplanes for 20 trips, far more than his predecessors. Then there are the little add-ons at taxpayer expense. For example, arriving at one airport in a rain, the governor noted that there were no umbrellas. No problem. His personal aide dashed off to a sporting goods outfit and came back with 20 of them, at a cost of $424. That's $21 each. What happened to competitive bidding? I can't get to all those places if I'm not able to fly, retorts the stern state budget slasher. Well, golly, Gov, no one's asking you to walk or even drive around your state, but five airlines have flights from Columbus to Cleveland. You're big on privatizing government services, so why not start with yourself by flying commercial? I only use a state plane when we have to use it, when I think the schedule demands it, the governor insists. Yeah, like on those essential trips you made to Canton and Cincinnati for press conferences to announce staff appointments. This is Jim Hightower saying, but then, budget cuts are for little people, not for Republican governors.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Every morning at the mine, you could see him arrive. He stood 6'6" and weighed 245, kind of broad at the shoulder and narrow at the hip. And everybody knew you didn't give no lip to Big John. Big John, Big John, Big Bad John.
As long as he's got his Kleenex, wipe the tears away. Anyway, yesterday, he was talking about... He's talking about possibly considering maybe, oh, gee, that Congress should consider cutting the multi-billion-dollar subsidy to oil companies. Because, you know, the price of gas is skyrocketing. Should we be giving them even more of our money? It's not bad enough that every time you go to the pump, it costs you an arm and a leg, and every trip to the grocery store around the corner is now a major economic decision. Nope. He's saying, maybe we should consider that. Maybe we should consider it. He said, quote, it's certainly something we should be looking at. We're in a time when the federal government's short on revenues, and they ought to pay their fair share, he says. But everybody wants to go after the oil companies, and frankly, they've got some part to blame in this. But he wants to see all the facts first. So, he does this interview. And his spokesman, and I love this because Reuters reported that according to Boehner's spokesman, Obama calling to end these oil and gas tax breaks, quote, would simply raise taxes and increase the price of gasoline at the pump. So last night in the ABC interview, now I'm just pointing this out, the crime master wants to see all the facts, and he thinks Congress should take a look. You know, at all of these massive incentives we're giving the oil industry. And now his spokesperson, it's going to raise taxes. So let me tell you what really happened. So Crime Master went out there and he said, you know what, maybe we should take a look at this. Maybe, you know, maybe you're trying to score some political points with the simple-minded. Maybe we should look at this because it's outrageous. So the oil masters and the Koch brothers and the rest of the special interests saw Boner flirting with the idea of taking away their cheese, and they went ballistic. And they made a quick phone call, said, you want campaign cash? Get somebody to retract that. So they sent their spokesman out there to go, yeah, well, you know, we can't do that. So basically the question I have is, what's the GOP plan then? Other than drill, baby, drill. Because that's all we're going to get from them. Drill, baby, drill. Just like their infrastructure policy of crumble, baby, crumble. And I point to this report by Michael Bromwich. He's the director of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Regulation and Enforcement. You know what he said? He said, look, we've been issuing permit after permit after permit. We've been, we've just been pushing it all out there. He said, even if we permitted the hell out of everything tomorrow, every pending permit, some permits that haven't even been filed yet, he said it would not have a material effect on gas prices. That's the simple, clear reality. He said you cannot drill your way to lower prices. You cannot. And he emphasizes the fact that we are in a world market. So even if we drilled more oil, like the congressman in this area, OGT, Representative Thompson, Glenn Thompson, GT, who says, and quite unabashedly, we should take the Marcellus Shale and we should sell it to those Chinese. We can make a whole bunch of money over there. Sell them to the Chinese. I thought, and maybe, help me here if I'm wrong, but I thought the whole Marcellus Shale thing, the whole reason that we're not taxing them, the whole reason that we're not regulating them, the whole reason that we've basically said, go ahead, is that they were going to produce energy for us. The country as a whole, us, you know, energy independent, gateway fuel to the renewable stuff. Remember that? Remember that whole discussion? Or am I wrong here? Did I miss that? Because, you know, at the end of this, Jake, I look at this and it's frustrating to me on a number of levels that we haven't invested enough into renewable fuels. We haven't invested enough into putting solar panels everywhere and windmills everywhere and doing all the things that we could do to ease our dependence on foreign nations.
You're absolutely right. And then you look at what happened over in Japan with the nuclear industry over there, and there was some hope in this country for a renewed resurgence in the nuclear industry, but after what happened over there, it's not going to happen. And here you have a golden opportunity to get us energy independence. And so far, we haven't handled the situation very well.
So today, you go back today, 25 years ago, some minor little thing happened. Some just little tiny little thing. Oh, yeah, Chernobyl. Yeah, today is the 25th anniversary of the explosion of number 4 reactor there in Chernobyl. It affected some 9 million people, the largest disaster in history. So here's the beautiful part of this. There's an international conference in Kiev last week that raised $803 million. And why did it raise $803 million? Why? Because the sarcophagus that they built to put over the containment area, over the place that had fallen apart, the place that had exploded, the big top hat. Remember when BP had their explosion? Operation Top Hat. Gonna put this thing on. So Operation Top Hat over the Chernobyl is now crumbling. So they need Top Hat 2. $803 million for Top Hat 2. And hopefully it'll be completed by 2015. Again, my problem with nuclear power. It might be okay. I don't think it's cheap. I don't think it's all that efficient. But it's sure once it goes wrong, it goes wrong. And you look in Perry, Ohio, the Perry Nuclear Power Plant. They're saying on Friday there was an incident that has caused some some reactions. There are radiation, elevated radiation readings going on there. So we'll find out more in the coming days, I'm sure. Just reports are that they're monitoring and the workers have identified the area that has the increased radiation. And the workers stopped and immediately left the area and, everything else was identified. So at this point, all we know is there's something that happened. I don't have the rest of that, but something happened. And again, I hear people saying, well, we need nuclear on the table. And even the president keeps saying it. We need to do the nuclear thing. No, sorry, not going there. No, there are other ways of doing this. We could make sound, smart, reasonable decisions by saying, you know what? We're going to have building codes that say that every house built from next year on has to produce at least half of its own energy through solar power, through geothermal, through any of the technologies that are out there. And it doesn't cost much more. I read an article recently that said, these folks are getting 80% of their energy needs from renewable sources. They're not really even on the grid there. They get 20% from the grid. Cost them about 15% more to build the house. That, to me, seems very rational.
Very reasonable.
Especially when you look down the road that is going to pay benefits for the next 20, 30 years. And it's going to help us as a nation get off the juice. It's going to help us look at places like the Middle East and say, you know what? You deal with it. Go ahead. Do what you got to do. And maybe all that craziness will stop. Maybe we'll stop interfering and poking our nose in the places where we don't really have, where we don't really have to be. But we're there because we know what we're doing. We're protecting our interests. Protecting our interests. Because we got interests all over the place. And interest is, honestly and truthfully, between you, me, and the fools, interests is basically U.S. corporations, big multinationals that we're defending. Like Smedley Butler said, when he wrote his piece, War is a Racket, he's gone all around the world for the bank boys and the fruit interests and all the sugar boys and all of these big multinational corporations that the U.S. has used their military to influence other countries to allow our businesses in to basically steal from them. And if you got time, read War is a Racket, Smedley Butler. Look up Major General Smedley Butler, and it'll come up. It's a 16-page little pamphlet, well worth the read, written back in the 30s. Just an excellent piece of history and of logic. I mean, you go back and you read that the war profiteers, back then were robbing the country blind and robbing the working class blind. Because at the end of the day, war makes rich people rich and poor people dead. And that is in a nutshell.
And if you look at many of the interventions in this century, at the heart of it was the very fact that we went into those countries to protect the corporate interest, plain and simple. Now, they might couch it and say, well, we didn't want a radical in this country, and we wanted to alleviate the suffering in this country. But I mean, at the end of the day, it was about protecting the interest of multinational.
So on the energy policy front, the folks over at the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center released a report. Of the 783 companies filed corporate net income tax returns in 2008, get this. This just blew my mind. Of the 783 companies that filed this corporate net income tax return, 85% paid nothing. 85%. 9 of the 10 top permit holders in the Marcellus Shale. 9 of the 10 top big boys. 9 of the 10 guys who got these permits, these gold lottery tickets. 9 of the 10 structured their business so that they didn't have to pay the corporate net income tax. No, they paid the personal income tax level, that much lower tax level. Basically cheating us out of our resource. And Sharon Ward, the director of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, said, quote, the drillers profiting from the rich gas reserves of Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale are getting a free pass. She says federal incentives significantly cut their tax bills at all levels. She says most drilling corporations pay no corporate income taxes, and the majority of all big oil and gas companies in the Marcellus Shale are paying the same tax rate as a person serving coffee at the corner diner. So basically, you got these big companies paying the same tax rate that you are. She goes, it goes on to say that the industry claims that they have paid more than $1 billion in state and local taxes, but you look at the Department of Revenue, you look at their numbers, you show that the in 2008, they only paid $38 million. So there's a huge difference between $38 million and $1 billion. They're out there saying, we paid $1 billion. Maybe that's what you collected and pocketed, but the state only got $38 million of it. And that includes $17.8 million in corporate net income taxes, $13 million in personal income tax, and $8 million in the capital stock and franchise tax. Now, what have the other states done? Look at states like Louisiana or Texas, you know, because Tom Corbett loves Texas. You look at West Virginia. They paid far more than $38 million. Far more. In fact, Texas paid more than 200 times more. They took in, get this, they took in $8.8 billion. $8.8 billion. You want to talk about a way to fill that budget gap? $8.8 billion. Louisiana took in $850 million. West Virginia took in $183 million. So, again, why aren't we taxing those folks? Again, why aren't we doing this? Especially when you got a congressman from Pennsylvania saying, oh, let's get that out in the international market. Big profit to be made by shipping it over to China. Oh, yeah. He thinks we're idiots. And to be honest, I'm starting to think we are, too. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Kutztown University professor Kevin Mahoney about this whole ridiculous budget issue. 56% cut from higher education. We're back after.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
PSECU, we know those holiday bills can really pile up and hit you with double-digit interest rates or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt. Dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer, good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our really big deal, 3.9% APR, is good through December 31st, 2012. And we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you used any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, move those high-interest rate balances to your PSECU Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing Life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life to get in on our really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Rebels are we, though heavy our hearts shall always be. Ah, no ball or chain, no prison shall keep grit of rebels of a sacred heart. Except no ball or chain, no prison shall keep grit of rebels of a sacred heart.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Looks like the nitwits over at FreedomWorks have got their henchmen out there tweeting away. This guy Spiels on Wheels tweeted, teachers unions and PA fighting against kids. Let's drown them out. Support SB1 and PA and give the kids a chance. And basically what they're talking about is they want all of their T-Twizzler nitwits to come out on May 3rd when the citizens of this state are going to rally against this budget and against SB1, and they're going to have their little counter rally, I guess. Maybe five or six people will show up. Maybe they can bus people in from out of state like they did in Wisconsin. Who knows? But I'm telling you, they're not going to get a larger crowd. And, you know, you look today, 1,000 kids came out, college kids who said, you know what, Governor, you're stealing my future. And I'm going to stand up and fight back, and good for them. Next time they come back, I hope they're 10,000, and I hope they bring sleeping bags, and I hope they stay. But one of the speakers today was a good friend of the program and a professor out of Kutztown University, Kevin Mahoney. Kevin, thanks for taking time for me, brother.
Hey, anytime, Rick, anytime.
You look at what happened today, and again, another very successful rally, another opportunity to organize and bring people together. But at the end of this, I think it's about not going home. It's about staying there until you get some satisfaction.
I agree. You know, and I think that on the way home, on the bus trip home, we kind of did a both first a grim check on what we're looking at, and then also kind of the call to organize again. And you know, again, I think that more people that come out to these rallies, that you start to see the light bulbs come on. Right? When you start seeing, you know, a 10-year-old kid come up to the mic and talk about the impact of this gutting of education through Corbett's budget, and talking about those kind of impacts, when you see the kind of talent that Pennsylvania schools have been producing and the music and the arts that were demonstrated there today, you know, you start to see folks say, you know what, I better get on the stick here, and I better show up again and again. And, you know, and what you mentioned there at the end, this is why I ended my talk today. You know, next time we come, plan on bringing your sleeping bags, because I agree, we got to be prepared to stay if we're going to be serious about this.
And it's got to be and I've had some people say, well, why don't you do it? And I will. You know, if the kids come, I will come and join them. But you've got to have the people who have the biggest stake in this. It is their future. If they're not willing to stand up and be part of this and really be the ones who drive it, I think it's very easily written off.
No, that's right. And I think that, you know, the risks, right? You know, this is something I think you hear a lot of early on in organizing, right? When you're, you know, just getting people mobilized, just getting people motivated, you know, the first question is, hey, well, why don't you do this? You know, and I'm very used to hearing that. And I give them kind of a similar response that you just said. I said, listen, you know, I'll do the work, right? But I need to know that there's folks behind, right? And I need for them to do some of the work, because this can't be me. I've got some skills here. You know, because the danger of that, right? You get a few of us out there who have been paying attention to this for a long time and pushing on this. And if we just kind of run, you know, full steam ahead, we're just going to be committing organizational suicide.
Right.
And that's going to help nobody in the long run, because then once you kind of cut off the organizers, then you got free reign. So, I mean, my concern in that, of course, is that we're in a place right now when, you know, I'm still using words like beginning to mobilize, and I'm feeling that pressure. You know, we need the thousands out there, and we need folks that are going to show their commitment. That's not going to come from just the result of one speech or one article they read, but from the kind of ongoing organization on the ground.
And the kind of mobilization that needs to happen. And it's painful to hear that we're at the beginning of this when the process is so far out in front of us with so much work to be done.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, that's the thing. And again, it's the hand we're dealt. For whatever reason, and we could speculate all day about what that is. But for whatever reason, that's really the hand that we're dealt. So, you know, we've been having now for a few weeks, conversations about, you know, what kind of infrastructure do we put in place, when our semester ends, you know, because in our situation, as you well know, you know, students leave for the semester, right? Now the good thing is, the good news of all this is that now we've got students who are beginning to do that organization and looking at it, hey, the semester's almost over, right? What's the next event? What's the next event? And we've got students who've got a lot of energy who are looking for, you know, hey, what's Governor Corbett's schedule? Why don't we pay him a visit? You know, they're looking, he's going to be coming to Albright on May 22nd. He's going to give him the commencement speech. So they thought, why not assemble a greeting party? You know, so there's that kind of energy that's moving forward, and those networks are beginning to solidify. So that's really good. But again, just exactly what you said, we're behind a curve on this one. And, you know, I don't know how else to put it. We're at a decisive moment in the history of public education in this state. If we don't step up now, I'm afraid we lose it all.
Step back a second. Albright, he's going to be giving a commencement speech at Albright College?
That's correct. That's in Reading, Pennsylvania, not far from Kutztown. He will be giving the commencement address, and we've had some students who have kind of made sure, is this true? Is this true? He's actually going to be there? And then Albright keeps on confirming that he's going to be there. So some folks are going to just, you know, pay him a little visit.
So conceivably what's going on there, the students who go to that school are going to lose 56% of the funding from the state as well.
Not Albright, no.
No?
No, not an Albright. Albright's a private school.
And no public funds go to those students?
No. No, I'm saying it. Albright, the public funds don't go there, but he's going to give his commencement address there.
Shame on them. Just absolutely shame on them. But I guess, you know, I guess then this is the perfect place for him.
Well,
because this is the direction. This is the direction then that this is going to go.
Yes. And, you know, and they have refused to cancel it. And, you know, again, we'll see where this goes. There's the more people that hear about this on the 22nd of May, the more that people are starting to look at it and say, you know what, maybe we should pay him a visit. Maybe we should pay him a visit. And I think that we got to start doing it every place he goes.
Not maybe. I think you're right. You need a caravan following him around.
Yep.
Everywhere he goes, there should be a sign.
I agree.
And, you know, maybe you have some people camped out by his house. I know where he lives.
Yeah, right down the road, right?
That's right. In a nice big gated house that we pay for.
Yep,
with servants
exactly.
And drivers and all kind of things.
It's unbelievable.
And yet they're talking about slashing education. You know,
really are. And you know what? And I think that not only this, I mean, you know, again, we keep on referring back to every time you and I have talked or when, you know, we're kind of doing organizing meetings, is that we always go back to the Wisconsin model, right? And it's important, man. I was, you know, following my Twitter feed today, and sure enough, you got students occupying administration buildings at the University of Wisconsin today. Right? They just left a few minutes ago after they were threatened with arrest and academic discipline. And that's all in response to a plan, right, basically to cut $250 million from the system over 2 years, right? And then $125 million just from the UW-Madison, right? And this is kind of, they were trying to reorganize the entire state system, right? And again, it's out of the playbook. This is the same thing. If I look back at something the chancellor of the Pennsylvania State of Higher Education issued in October in 2010, talk about the plan for transformation, right? Talk about transforming Tashi, right? And this is the same principle, right? This is where you got to see these folks, whether they're kind of on the right-wing ideologue side of it or they see themselves as pragmatists, it doesn't matter. These folks are kind of moving out of a playbook that's looking to transform public resources.
And basically hock off the commons to the lowest bidder, because you're not getting high bids for this stuff.
No way. No way.
And again, you look back and you look at the private universities that are out there with the huge profits, the huge failure rates, the default rates, the huge debt that the students in those places have. That's the future of education in this country.
That is. That's precisely what they're looking at. You know, and these students that came out today for the NAACP rally, you know, the grade school students, the ones that spoke there, right, they get it. You know, I mean, they get it, especially these students that are coming out of Philadelphia, and they know their schools have been hit, and they've been hit over and they hit over. They've been the victims of a system of privatization of schools, right? There's schools, you know, we have schools that kind of go out of business, which is an unbelievable concept. The school just goes out of business. And you got these kids like scrambling around looking for schools. You got all sorts of corruption. You got give backs that are going on down there. That's the future we're looking at. So these kids are already kind of in the middle of this, and they're only in sixth grade. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear you.
But that's the education that they're getting. The education they're getting from our public schools is that they're going to get sold out to the highest bidder, right? And the highest bidder, as you said, is not bidding all that much.
And this is, you know, you're talking about SB1 and the whole idea of pushing these vouchers and, you know, these lottery tickets that nobody's ever going to validate. What bothers me about this is exactly what you said. What you will see is all of these private, fly-by-night transient guys who think they've got the next winning system going to come in, and they're going to be gone within days, and it's going to disrupt the entire system. It's going to make it actually much worse and much more costly.
Absolutely. You know, and then there's a second tier of all this too as well. And this goes back to something that I've heard you talk about frequently on the show, is that what we're seeing here is a very calculated effort to start splitting kind of sectors of the electorate, kind of splitting citizen against citizen. And it's coming right now out of the kind of Republican caucuses that are positioning themselves as quote-unquote pragmatists, right, as defenders of education, right? But there's been a series of news reports, some careful news reporting on this, and they're showing what they're going to do. Okay, we're going to restore PASHE funding, right, for the state system by taking it out of social services, yep. Right? So you're going to basically, okay, sure, we're going to put the funds back to the school, but the kids that are going to that school aren't going to have any food in their stomach, or their parents' house is going to get foreclosed on, and they got no place to go.
Yep. Well, and then they're going to ask, they make us thank them for it.
That's right, and it'll send them off to the prison, which Corbett funds lavishly.
Well, again, those are for profit, Kevin.
Yeah, what am I thinking, right?
There's money there. So let's go back to this. I got about it left. What do we do? Where do we go from here? What are you guys planning?
Well, I'll tell you, May 3rd, we got a car caravan that are going on May 3rd out to the kind of rally for a responsible budget. We're going to be out there with labor on the 3rd all day once again. 22nd, we'll be at Albright with Corbett and give me a little greeting party. And we're looking for every opportunity to be out there in Harrisburg. And we're convincing, we're trying to convince the folks when we come out on the 3rd, by plan on bringing your sleeping bags, right? Maybe we'll stay a while.
Well, we're going to come to both events. If you're going out to Albright, we're going to be there with you.
Excellent, man.
Kevin, always great talking to you. Keep up the passion. Keep up the faith. I'll talk to you very soon.
You do it too, man. We need you.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous. The salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make pathways happen!
Just when he thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
This is going to scare the hell out of the lunatic fringe radical right wing. Just going to basically run them out into the streets screaming and carrying on, hands above head, waving like crazy. You know, the people who keep the government out of my life. Because we want them in your bedroom. You're going to love this. The AP reported for the very first time, American women have passed men in gaining advanced degrees. Not to mention the advanced degrees, master's degrees, PhDs, also bachelor's degrees. And what they're saying here in the AP piece is it's part of a trend that's helping redefine who's going off to work and who's raising the youngins. The census figures were released today highlight the latest education milestones for women, according to the AP, who began, they say, to exceed men in college enrollment in the early 80s. The findings come among record shares of women in the workplace and a steady decline in stay-at-home mothers. Because really, you can't control them if they don't need you. If women don't need you, you can't control them, which is what the Republicans absolutely need. They need to be able to control women. The AP article goes on to say the educational gains for women are giving them greater access to a wider range of jobs, contributing to a shift of traditional gender roles at home and at work. Based on one demographer's estimate, the number of stay-at-home dads who are the primary caregivers of their children has reached nearly 2 million last year, 1 in 15 fathers. That is pretty amazing. And to be honest, I would have loved to stay home with my kids. I would have. And if I could have sent my wife out to work, that would have been, I think, great. It would be a wonderful thing to be able to watch them and participate in their growing up. But I made a little bit more money. I think people who have the opportunity, it's a great thing. Mark Perry, an economics professor at the University of Michigan there in Flint, he said the gaps we're seeing in bachelor's and advanced degrees mean that women will be better protected against the next recession. He says that men now might be the ones more likely to be staying at home doing the more traditional child rearing. And this has the traditional family people, the Rick Santorums of the world, absolutely losing their mind because women are attaining these much higher degrees. And, you know, I look at Representative Alan West from Florida. And again, you know, this is brought to you from the lesser Carolina, actually even lesser than Georgia, who was talking to a group of women, a very conservative group, the Women Impacting the Nation conservative group, where he said, and I'm going to read it first, and I'm going to play it for you because it's amazing. He said, "We need you to come out and lock shields to strengthen up the men that will go in to fight for you. Let these other women know." On the other side, these Planned Parenthood women, the Code Pink women, and all of these women who have been neutering American men and bringing us to the point of this incredible weakness, to let them know that we're not going to have our men become subservient. Listen to him.
"We need you to come in and lock shields.
That's right.
And strengthen
That's
up the
right.
man that will go into the fight for you. Mm-hmm. To let these other women know on the other side, these Planned Parenthood women, the Code Pink women, and all of these women who that have been neutering American men
neutering.
And bringing us to the point of this incredible weakness, to let them know that we are not going to have our men become subservient."
No, I'm not going to have them become subservient and raise those children and stay at home. Not going to do it. So we're going to strip rights away from women now. We're going to take it away while we still can. And his justification for why we have to do this, I can't make this stuff up. Listen to this.
"That's what we need you to do. Because if you don't do it, then the debt will continue to grow."
That's right. If we don't do this, if we don't go down the road and strip all these rights from women and put them barefoot and pregnant back in the house where they belong, it's going to add to the debt. The debt will continue to grow. The debt. It's amazing, isn't it? It's beautiful. So I flipped to another station on ABC Family. ABC Family. The 700 Club. Insaniac Pat Robertson. I can't make this stuff up. He says the far left supported a culture of death that was livid about killing babies.
"The far left is livid, about killing babies."
Yeah, just livid about killing babies. You know, they just love going out there. They were angry about killing babies, which I'm not quite, I'm sure livid was not the word he was thinking of. But again, kooky old man. He goes on to say this. This is another wow.
If a woman is a lesbian, what advantage does she have over a married woman? What deficiency does she have?
Well, she can't have children.
That's exactly right. So if these married women don't have children, if they abort their babies, then it kind of puts them on a level playing field. Now you say, well, nobody's there to express that. Isn't that shocking? Well, think about it a little bit, ladies and gentlemen.
What the hell is he talking about? I mean, did he fail basic anatomy? I mean, just because a woman likes another woman doesn't mean that the both of them can't get pregnant. It's the whole sperm and egg thing. I hope I don't have to explain it. Maybe, you know, I look at Pat Robertson. It's probably been a long time. It's probably been quite some time since he was out running around. So maybe he doesn't get it. I don't know. But this whole idea that, you know, if these women, these married women don't have children and they abort their babies, kind of puts them on a level playing field. What the hell are you talking about? What are you talking about, you crinkled up old fruitcake? And I say that in the most enduring fashion. I mean, the guy's loony. Well, you know, think about it, ladies and gentlemen. Think about it. Could happen to anybody. Those lesbians, they can't have children. Because we're neutering American men.
Think about it a little bit, ladies and gentlemen.
Just think about it. I mean, is that not one of the craziest things you've ever heard? I mean, he's said some pretty crazy stuff over the years. This guy is way out on the deep end. And this made me go, really? Can I even talk about this? Can I even point out how insane this is? The idea that, well, you know, it puts them on a level playing field with lesbians. What?
Obviously, he doesn't know much about women who seek abortions.
Obviously, he doesn't know much about women. Because I'm sitting there and I'm watching these two nitwits go back and forth. And he's going, well, come on. Give me what I need. Well, they would be deficient. Yes, they couldn't have babies. Who's to say? Again, you know, I don't know, man. It's just plain nuts. And this is what happens when you get a dimwit who is now someone that other people follow. He scares me because he built that little 700 club thing into a billion-dollar station. He built that into it. He's a smart guy business-wise because he knew a bunch of these extremely easy, gullible, easy to lead, gullible people will throw him money and will hang on every word. I know tomorrow there's going to be someone to say, you know, I heard Pat say that married women who have abortions are on evil playing field with lesbians. And they won't know what the hell they're talking about either. So we got a whole nation full of people. I'm scared. You know, like I tell my wife, hold me. I'm scared. When the guy called me a fascist communist, I just told my wife, hold me. I'm scared. The nation, the national intellect has just fallen through the floor. You know, my God. Yes, that is what it is. Because, you know, we need to have our women tied up and barefoot and pregnant. And I got to be honest, and I've said this before, I would be all in favor of it. I would love to have my wife subservient to me, doing everything I want, everything I can think of, like cooking me dinner and painting the house and doing all the cutting the grass, you know, all of those things that I don't want to do. I would love to have that, but my problem is I got two daughters, and some guy who they will probably end up marrying and bringing home before I have to
be dad.
Before I have to kill them. You know, when they bring them home, you know, I'm going to have to put the fear of something into them.
To meet his approval.
But at some point, you know, they're going to be married, and I want them to be equals. I don't want some guy to think I'm dominant of you. And like these people, like these folks who are scared to death of empowering half of the population. Scary, scary, scary stuff. And I'm amazed that women go along with it. Just amazed. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with David Bacon. Back after this.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born.
Rick Smith. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Public opinion is strongly against cutting Medicare. A Washington Post ABC poll shows 78% of Americans are against cutting it to reduce the national debt. The Republican House budget would end Medicare as we know it, including creating fixed vouchers to force seniors to buy private insurance instead. 65% of the American people are against doing that. This is massive opposition to a key element of the Republican budget plan, reminiscent of the massive opposition George W. Bush ran into when he tried to privatize Social Security. Republicans got a first-hand taste of that intense opposition to gutting Medicare while they were back in their congressional districts for the Easter recess. Paul Ryan was booed at a town hall meeting, and in event after event, many other Republicans also faced hostile voters angry about the plan attacking Medicare. Southern California grocery workers have authorized a strike as talks continue to try to avert that outcome. Jesse Russell reports.
A substantial number of grocery workers in Southern California voted in favor of strike action last week. The workers are represented by United Food and Commercial Workers Local 770, and they are currently in negotiations with a number of grocery chains in the region. The workers and chains have been negotiating since February, and the union has said the strike vote was simply a precautionary measure, as neither side wants to see talks devolve into either a walkout or a lockout. The same region currently in negotiations saw a historic strike and lockout in 2003, which lasted for 4 months. The stalemate was painful for both workers and the chains.
Workers for a Honeywell uranium conversion facility in Metropolis, Illinois have been locked out of that plant for 10 months. The workers are represented by the United Steelworkers, who took the struggle of the 228 Illinois workers to the Honeywell shareholders meeting in Morristown, New Jersey yesterday. Jeremy Long is with USW Local 7669.
What we're dealing with is the union's not wanting to accept what the company's offering. And what the company's offering is they're wanting to do away with jobs by contracting them out, plus they want to do with your seniority rights. You know, the health care, we've done settled on the health care and the wages. The union's done said that we're open to increasing our wages.
They've been locked out since June 28th of 2010, with the most recent negotiating session being held April 20th. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals, and by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Shielders, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come on, you good workers, good news to you out there. Oh, now look at all the union has going here to clear.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, last night I recited a portion of the Pledge of Allegiance that I remember having pounded into me as a child going through grade school. And basically I focused on the points: one nation, indivisible, liberty and justice for all. Got a couple of people riled up because I forgot the God. But I had to remind them that it wasn't there originally, but if you have to. It's that liberty and justice part that gets me. And, you know, our friends on the right, they love, you know, touting the flag and the Constitution, but when it comes to people, there doesn't seem to be much justice, much liberty going on, especially when it comes to trade and it comes to immigration policy. Just doesn't. I've got David Bacon on the line. He's a writer and author, a photojournalist. A couple of his books are fantastic. The book Illegal People is How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Immigrants is an excellent read. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick. Good to be here.
I appreciate you taking time for me. You know, the immigration debate is going to be heating up very soon, and I get it all the time. This idea that we have all these illegal people here. For me, I look at it and I say, you know, if we had more jobs, we wouldn't have this big of a problem.
That's right, actually. I think, well, you know, it's part of what happens in this country that hysteria about immigration gets a lot worse when unemployment rises, and this isn't something that's just happened recently. This, you know, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we had riots against Chinese immigration at the turn of the century, where people's neighborhoods were burned out and people were killed in them. So, you know, this has been going on for a while, and it's kind of, you know, and in a way, it's not unique even to this country. Everywhere in the world, where people get insecure and worry about being able to keep their jobs, then you get a lot of hysteria when unemployment rises. And, you know, I used to be a union organizer for a long time, and one of the first things that I learned as an organizer was getting mad at your boss is dangerous, but getting mad at other workers around you is a lot safer. And so people scapegoat the workers around them rather than taking a look at who's really responsible for creating unemployment and who it really benefits.
Yeah, absolutely, and a good point. You know, when I look at and I go back to NAFTA, to me that was the beginning of a lot of this, not all of it, but a lot of it, where we had seen the Mexican government change part of their constitution to be part of this this trade agreement. Which really is a horrible agreement, where they stole land from the folks who lived there and basically caused this mass migration of people to the north. I try to explain to people that, you know, we created part of this mess, and it's this whole movement of our jobs from here to Mexico and then off to China eventually, that has caused a lot of this. But if we had a growing economy with sane trade policies, a lot of this wouldn't be on the agenda.
That's right. NAFTA really had a terrible impact on people in Mexico, which really a lot of working people in our country don't see very clearly, because we see that it cost us a lot of jobs here, that those jobs went to Mexico. So people think, well, okay, if those jobs went to Mexico, then Mexicans must have benefited. But the first year that NAFTA was in effect, in 1994, these wrenching changes in the Mexican economy that it caused led to 1 million Mexicans losing their jobs. That was way, way, way more in just 1 year than all the jobs that ever went to Mexico in the entire time that NAFTA has been in effect. But it wasn't just jobs. It was structural changes in the Mexican economy. Mexico, for instance, had what we would call in this country a domestic content law, which said that the big auto plants in Mexico had to buy a certain percentage of the parts that went into the cars that they were assembling from Mexican producers. Well, NAFTA said that's an unfair restriction on foreign corporations, and so they abolished that, and the Mexican parts industry went belly up because those big auto manufacturers started bringing in parts from wherever it was cheaper, and thousands of Mexicans lost their jobs in that one. The treaty let big U.S. grain companies like Archer Daniels Midland and Continental Grain and Cargill dump corn on the Mexican market. Now, we subsidize that corn. Our farm bill, which is to say our tax money, pays $2 billion in subsidies to grain producers in this country. What that really did was it lowered their cost of production, and it allowed them to sell corn in Mexico in order to take over the market there at a price that was so low that Mexican farmers couldn't grow it and sell it at that price and make enough money to just pay for the cost of growing it. So in many, many, many hundreds and thousands of small towns throughout Mexico that are corn farming towns, where people have been doing this for generations and generations, all of a sudden people couldn't survive that way any longer. And those people, too, had to join this huge number of people that were essentially looking for work. And because there were no jobs in Mexico, in large part because of that trade agreement and these kinds of pro-corporate policies, people did what they had to do in order for their families to survive. And I think, Rick, that every listener in this program here should ask themselves and think to themselves this question here. If you were in a position of not having a job, not being able to provide for your family, if your kids were hungry, they didn't have the clothes they needed to go to school, I think all of us would do whatever it took.
I don't need
for
to think about it.
Survive.
I don't need to think about it. I know I would do whatever it took, and it wouldn't take me but a split second to cross that border to what, you know, is viewed as paradise, the land of plenty, the land of opportunity. There's not a question in my mind. that's where I would be.
That's right. And I think it's because, you know, that, you know, underneath the nationality, underneath the skin, so to speak, we're all the same. We all love our families. We all want to do what we can for our children to have a better life. You know, one of the big problems that we have in this country these days is that our children are having a standard of living that is lower than ours. I have kids that are graduating from college and can't find work. And when they can't find it, they get jobs doing retail jobs at a little more than minimum wage. You know, unless something radical happens in our country, my kids, and I don't make a really great living myself, but my kids are going to have a standard of living that's lower than mine. So I think that on both sides of the border, we are seeing our wages and our standards of living and the benefits that we are used to getting as part of what our parents and our grandparents fought for, we're seeing those go up in smoke. We're seeing those disappear. That's what Madison is all about, right?
Yep.
Is that we're seeing our right to have a union, our right to have a pension, our right to have health care. These are things that people fought for. You know, they didn't come from the sky. You know, we fought for them, and our parents and grandparents did, and they are disappearing. And our kids are going to grow up, unless we do something, our kids are going to grow up and live in a world without them. Think about that. What is our life for our kids going to be like in a world without pensions when they get old? You know, are they going to eat dog food and live in SROs? You know, it's a really scary thought.
That's where the radical right seems to want to take us back to. They want to destroy Medicare. They want to destroy Social Security. They want to tear that social safety net apart even more than they have already. Again, frustrating. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with David Bacon, author, photojournalist. His website, dbacon.igc.org. You can get there from our site at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on David Bacon's name. It'll take you right to his website. Some fantastic photographs. You know, let me ask you this, because, you know, I have some folks that I know, and that we've had some callers call in and say, you know, I work in construction, and I've been laid off, or I can't find a job, and I see all of these migrant workers coming in. I see all of the Mexican workers coming in, taking those jobs. Don't you think it's just natural for them to look and lash out at that, at some level?
Well, it's something that has gone on in this country for a long time. But we have never lived in a period of time in which we didn't have competition for those jobs out there, in which we didn't have employers who always were looking for workers who were cheaper than us, whoever the us is, you know. So when it was convenient for employers to pit African American workers against white workers, they certainly did that. You know, when they could pit immigrants against people who were native born, they've done that too. You know, you look at the history of how unions got organized in steel mills or in auto plants back east. You had immigrants from Europe, from one country, being put into competition with immigrants from other countries in Europe. So it's not just about the color line, although the color line in our world makes that kind of competition. It gives us kind of a racial edge to it. But it is part of our world. And so the answer that we have had as working people in this country is we have to organize everybody together.
And
the only way to deal with it is if we can get ourselves together. So when building trades workers look at that non-union job and see a lot of Mexican workers on that job, there are two possible things that you can think in response to that. One is, you know, those jobs belong to us. Get those workers out of there, and maybe the boss will give me that job. What that does, that produces a race to the bottom in which we are competing against each other to see who's going to work for the lowest wage.
Right.
The other way of responding to that is to say, hey, we all need to belong to the same union here. If we all belong to the same union, whether we're Mexican or white or black or whoever we are, and we set a wage that we are willing to work for and no less, then we can try and force employers to agree to that. That's what unions are all about. That's what they do.
That's an excellent point. And it's kind of the position I've taken over the years. You talk about the race to the bottom, and the reality is we have seen this massive race to the bottom here in this country alone, because we have so many bad labor laws. I mean, it's so disjointed, so all over the map. But if you look at Mexico, it's even worse in Mexico with their labor laws. And it seems to me that we're heading down to where they are. You look at the Colombian trade agreement that they're talking about, this whole idea of being business friendly. How much more business friendly is it that you can throw trade unionists out of planes?
That's right. You know, in Mexico, people are really facing the same set of employers that we are. You know, the big companies are kind of the same on both sides of the border. The last president of Mexico before the current one, Vicente Fox, was an executive for the Coca-Cola Corporation. So that tells you a little bit about who's in charge in Mexico these days. And the same way that in Madison, we are fighting against the changes in our law to remove our right to have a union, Mexicans are fighting the same kind of fight as well, too. Actually, Mexican labor law on paper is pretty good. Mexican workers have some rights that we would kind of give our eye teeth for. Mexican labor law says that outsourcing, that companies can't do it, that once you get hired, you have a permanent job, and if the company goes belly up and lays you off, you have a right to severance pay. We don't have any laws like that here. In a Mexican strike, workers are entitled, in a legal strike, to put flags across the door into the workplaces on strike, and not even the boss can go in there, let alone strike breakers. You know, I have organized many strikes myself in which the police escorted strike breakers into wherever it was that we were on strike, basically saying, well, the company has the right to do business whether you're on strike or not. In Mexico, people have had a law that protects them against that. But the problem is in Mexico is that those laws are being changed just the way ours are.
Yeah, and there's no enforcement.
First of all, the problem was that they have really not been enforced adequately for a long, long time. Just the way ours are. You know, in this country, if you join a union, it's illegal for your boss to fire you or to discriminate against you. But any worker knows that if you join a union and your boss finds out about it, your job could be on the line because companies fire people for that all the time.
All the time.
And we have very little enforcement of our law. Same thing in Mexico.
You look at the decision that just came down from the General Counsel of the NLRB over the Boeing decision, and the country's, you know, the right is all a tizzy that how dare the labor, National Labor Board tell those workers that they have the right to strike, and how dare they, you know, tell a company that they can't infringe on those rights enforced it.
I know this one's really kind of unbelievable here, because here you have a large corporation, Boeing, that said in so many words, in interviews, in newspapers, we are going to move these jobs because those workers went on strike too many times and we don't like it. The law says that that is illegal. And here we have all these right-wing politicians saying, law's law, you know, we don't care what the law says. The company should be entitled to run its business any way it wants. You know, what kind of enforcement of the law, what kind of rule of law do we have in this country?
Yeah, the law be damned.
A company can do that.
Well, I mean, we've seen the governors across this state, the Republican governors, who have looked at the rule of law and said, it doesn't apply to us. You know, I was in Madison when the Republicans illegally passed that, rammed through that theft of collective bargaining. It was illegal.
Right, the dead of night.
But they did it like thieves in the night.
Right, right. Exactly.
Last question.
Well, you know, at least they knew that they had to hide what they were doing from daylight, but, you know, it didn't stop them, did it?
Kind of hard to do that with thousands of people in the rotunda there.
I know that. That's something that made me feel really good when I saw those pictures coming out of Madison of all those people in the rotunda and then in the, you know, outside. And you know, I live in California. You know, we don't have snow where I live. And to think that thousands and thousands of people were out there every day in the middle of the cold and the snow, it just made you feel good that people were that dedicated and that committed to fighting for their rights.
Yeah, we drove 13 hours to get there to spend a week there. Got to sleep inside the Capitol on the marble floor. Marble's cold, in case you didn't know.
I'll bet it is.
But again, it was a historic moment. I'm glad we went and we were able to bring that to our listeners. Last question I've got for you. You know, one of the things, and I've been against this. President Obama has this intent to open up the Mexican border to Mexican domiciled trucks. I'm curious what your take on that is.
Well, I think that the answer to this one is solidarity. We need, and here we're talking about Teamsters especially, we need to help those workers in Mexico who drive those trucks organize themselves and start fighting for their rights and bringing up their wages and their working conditions. One of the reasons why companies want this trucking agreement, is because there really is no union for truckers in Mexico. You know, whether they are owner-operators or they are long-haul drivers working for somebody else. You know, the steel workers here in the United States, their answer to a similar situation involving copper miners, and we have copper mines on both sides of the border as well, too, has been to not only help the Mexican miners' union survive, but actually they're talking about merging the two unions together and having one union for miners in both the U.S. and in Mexico. So I think that if we were successful in doing that, in helping Mexican truckers to organize themselves and having a strong union that was fighting for their rights, I think all of a sudden, you know, U.S. trucking companies would lose interest really fast in an agreement about Mexican drivers driving in the United States. The reason why they want Mexican truckers driving in the United States is because they believe that they can get a driver who will drive that load inside the United States at a wage that will be just a fraction of what a U.S. Teamster would get. And so the only way that we can keep that from happening or stop it is by bringing up those wages. And the only way that we have historically of bringing up wages in this country is not by, you know, appealing to the goodness of the heart of the employers or our government, but it's organizing unions and fighting for wage increases. That's what we have to do here.
At the end of it, it's the organizing part, but it's a right. Long road to getting to that. David Bacon, I appreciate your time. You do great work and some amazing photographs. Again, dbacon.igc.org. There's a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. I suggest checking it out. David, I appreciate your time, brother.
Hey, it was a pleasure being with you, Rick.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
For the rest of us, Rick Smith.
One morning in March, Ohio's pious anti-spending governor, John Kasich, got up, brushed his teeth, and went to the Capitol to announce that he was slashing spending on schools, teachers, and other public employees. Gotta balance the budget, he lectured. The very next morning, Kasich got up, brushed his teeth, and went to an airport in Columbus, where he climbed aboard a state-owned King Air to fly him 144 miles to Cleveland to give a speech. His traveling entourage was so big that the governor's hop to Cleveland required two airplanes. Cost to taxpayers, $2,200 just for the short flight. Indeed, this small government champion turns out to be a fly-happy believer in socialized transportation. For him. In only his first 3 months in office, Kasich used government airplanes for 20 trips, far more than his predecessors. Then there are the little add-ons at taxpayer expense. For example, arriving at one airport in a rain, the governor noted that there were no umbrellas. No problem. His personal aide dashed off to a sporting goods outfit and came back with 20 of them, at a cost of $424. That's $21 each. What happened to competitive bidding? I can't get to all those places if I'm not able to fly, retorts the stern state budget slasher. Well, golly, Gov, no one's asking you to walk or even drive around your state, but five airlines have flights from Columbus to Cleveland. You're big on privatizing government services, so why not start with yourself by flying commercial? I only use a state plane when we have to use it, when I think the schedule demands it, the governor insists. Yeah, like on those essential trips you made to Canton and Cincinnati for press conferences to announce staff appointments. This is Jim Hightower saying, but then, budget cuts are for little people, not for Republican governors.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
I go back to that. I go back to the cross-border trucking issue. And again, you know, philosophically, I'm right there with David Bacon. Organize them, bring their wages up, lift them up. Give us the ability to go into Mexico. My problem is I don't know any American drivers willing to go into Mexico, especially with the problems that they've got with their legal structure being different than ours. I don't know how much I trust our State Department to bail me out in the event that I get into a minor fender bender, or the local federales want to take the little bite, and I forget the word for it, morbido or something, where they call it. It's the little bite, where you didn't do anything wrong, but you know, you're a rich white American truck driver. Hand us a couple of dollars.
Well, the Mexican government doesn't, when it comes to free trade and suppressing human labor reaction, the Mexican government has at times been brutal. So I'm not so sure that you can trust the Mexican government in this issue to be hands off, because they have a stake in this.
And now look, you know, if I were a Mexican driver, I don't know that I would want to come into the states of Arkansas, Georgia, Alabama, any of the southern states. I don't think I'd want to come into at least half of the country for the same fears that you're going to run into some yokel local sheriff. Well, I don't like your can around here. You know, you sure got a pretty mouth. I just don't know that I would be all that thrilled with it if I were them either. So this is a lose-lose, I think. For me, I think you keep things the way it is. You have that trade zone where you get some free movement across the borders, especially when we need jobs. I mean, they keep saying that this whole thing is to streamline the process and speed up the free trade. What they're really talking about doing is cutting employment, cutting jobs, and increasing profit. That's what it's about. And, of course, destroying the American trucking industry, which, I mean, they've already done. I mean, there are very few unionized carriers left. They have done a very good job of destroying them, and not having laws that are so arcane and so outdated and so cumbersome that you can't organize new drivers. You know, I talk to independents all the time who say, you know, they'd love to be part of a union. They would love to have the security and the collective bargaining ability, but they're classified as independent contractors, like our buddy that worked at FedEx. Independent contractor. I wear the uniform, I abide by the rules, the truck says FedEx, but I'm an independent contractor. What that means? It means I don't get workers' comp, I don't get unemployment, I don't get a whole bunch of the Social Security thing, I don't get any of that stuff. I get paid by the package. Or by a contractor. Somebody else. Amazing stuff. Anyway, a little labor history today. Back in 1924, the House of Representatives passed House Joint Resolution 184, which is a constitutional amendment that would prohibit the labor of persons under the age of 18. The Senate approved the measure a few weeks later, but it was never ratified by the states. And I guess technically it's still pending because it has passed. It just hasn't been ratified by all the states. I would guarantee that Missouri, with the crazy people there who want to basically gut child labor laws and get those 16-year-old girls working the hotels again, as long as we give them a place to lay down. I mean, stop and think about it. I mean, that was part of their ruling. I'm not making that up. That's part of that Cunningham woman's law. I can't make that up. I'm not that smart. Also today, 1944, on the orders of President Roosevelt, the U.S. Army seized the Chicago headquarters of the unionized Montgomery Ward and Company after the management defied the National Labor Relations Board. Ah, back when people actually enforced what the National Labor Board had to say. Now we just criticize them. Well, the people on the radical right. Which is why I think that Boeing decision is so important. Even though it is just the general counsel's decision at this point, and it's going to go through the process, I think it's important to say, look, you can't be that blatant. You can't come out and say, you know what? We're moving this because we're punishing you. We're taking your right to strike away. It's a right right now. It's part of the law, in case you didn't know. Anyway, back in 1975, on this date, with unemployment somewhere around 9%, some 60,000 union members and other activists marched on Washington, D.C. Why? They wanted jobs. And they wanted jobs for all Americans, not just unionized. Also, today in 2009, with the car industry here in the U.S. tanking, the U.S. auto workers agreed to massive concessions with Chrysler Corporation in return for 55% of the company's stock. The union then sold the shares. And what did they do with it? They funded health care for their retirees. They didn't put it in their pocket. Not like our friends on the radical right would do. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We'll come back right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Oh, Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. Our good friend Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
The president and John Boehner are at it, I guess?
They certainly are, and this has to do with him saying, Boehner, that is, saying that he was he thought, well, maybe we shouldn't be paying such subsidies. So the president took off immediately on that and sent him a letter, sent the speaker a letter, and said, hey, you know, we appreciate that you're pretty open to this, and I'm writing to urge you to take immediate action to eliminate the unwarranted tax breaks for the oil and gas industry. And he said that we need to work immediately on the longer-term goal of reducing dependence on foreign oil and our vulnerability to price fluctuations.
Did you see what Boehner's spokesman said, that, you know, if we took the subsidies away, the price of gas would go up?
I mean, it's so out of crazy that because the oil, according to the White House, the oil industry will be reporting this week on their money, and it's huge, actually. I mean, they are going to report record profits.
Yeah, but, you know, as the right says, you know, it's only a small percentage, though. Only a small percentage. Would you deprive that poor corporation of that really small percentage?
It's pretty amazing, all I have to tell you. Pretty darn amazing.
Well, you know, nothing surprises me when it comes down to this. Nothing common sense can ever happen in that town of yours. Which is, you know, if you believe in the free market, as the radical right folks do, this whole blind faith ideology that the market will decide, why are we subsidizing the oil industry? Why are we giving tax breaks to GE? Why are we giving all this money out?
Well, and it was interesting because my friend April Ryan said, you know, the president, I guess Tavis Smiley had said on a show that the president was doing nothing for African-American jobs. So April Ryan picked right up on that from American Urban Radio Network today at the White House briefing. And she said, well, okay, what are you doing? And all we got from the press secretary was essentially, hey, the president has done quite a bit on this. And he has done a lot of work on essentially trying to do General Motors so that people can get jobs. And he saved $1 million.
A million jobs.
Give me a break.
Right. Well, I got to be honest with you. There needs to be a lot more done, an awful lot more done. Maybe we should just invade another country. That might create jobs.
Maybe.
Speaking,
and that has certainly been top of the hit parade.
Yeah, well, and speaking of that, I mean, we've got some craziness going on in Syria right now.
Oh, we certainly do. And the White House has been very vocal about this, as have the Brits, but they're saying it's a very different situation than Libya. You have essentially a different dictator, more multicultural society, and that they can begin to really put pressure on internationally. Now, it is true, when I was in Syria about 6-7 years ago, the European Union was all over there with financial things. So I think that there does seem to be a difference between Syria. But let's face it, it is because we have a lot of financial interest there, and so does the European Union.
Right. Yeah, another situation I really don't think we should be getting ourselves involved in, but we're going to, I think. Energy in the news?
Well, energy is in the news. Actually, the White House had a very rare kind of discussion about that today, Rick, and they said that they are taking a look at the national security implications of energy, particularly as it results in our troops. And they are saying that by having a flexible solar panels, et cetera, that we are not going to rely so much on energy for our troops. They also said that, and this was a statistic I'm sure you spend a little more time in these kind of statistics than I do, but $1 billion a day is what we lose to foreign energy, and it is half of our trade deficit.
Right. you know, at some point, you know, maybe we'll get the point. You know, I've been asking what the squeal point is. Is it $8 a gallon? Is it $10 a gallon before we start really investing? I mean, what we've been doing, I'll be honest, I think is just nibbling around the edge. When we really go full tilt and say we're going to make this country energy independent, that's the only way we're going to be a secure nation.
Well, that's true, and I think that the White House certainly knows that. And I think what they're also trying to do is to try and get the Republicans to agree on an energy plan.
Yeah, other than drill, baby, drill?
Other than drill, baby, drill, that's right. Because they're trying to say, take this $4 billion and actually move it to green technologies.
That sounds like a good idea to me. It's a good start in the right direction. But, again, you know, the Republican plan for energy is drill, baby, drill, just like their infrastructure plan is crumble, baby, crumble, because our bridges seem to be crumbling down around us. And lastly, our good friend Senator Bernie Sanders in the news.
That's right. Bernie Sanders, he did a very interesting thing, and he actually asked the GAO to come up with to say what had happened with these – zero interest funds from the Federal Reserve to banks, and then what the banks did is they took the zero interest loan from the Federal Reserve, and then they lent it back to the government, making a lot of money. And he lists a whole bunch of people. For instance, J.P. Morgan Chase took $10 billion in federal loans with a 0.6% interest, and then it held $10 billion in U.S. government securities with an average yield of 1.7%. So, again, even though they're dealing with small percentages, they made out like a bandit.
Oh, absolutely. And here's the thing that it gets me. How do I get a 0.6% loan? You know, how do I get something like that? How does a small business person, if we were to give that money out to small businesses to help maybe go after some of the new energy, do you think we could grow our economy?
That is the ultimate question, and so I think we could, but I think we're going to have to stop supporting big businesses and start supporting things that make jobs.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I agree with Ron Paul on is we should be looking at the Fed and how much of that money went to the modern day Dillingers, because, you know, I've said there, we don't have any more colorful bank robbers. We get idiots who write "I'm robbing the bank" on the back of their paycheck stub with their name and address on it. All the colorful figures, they're bank presidents now, because it's easier just to become a CEO to rob banks. Which is exactly what has happened.
Well, you're right, and it needs to happen. So anyway, that's the story.
So when's Bernie going to go after putting some of these crooks in jail?
Well, you know, he'd love to have hearings, and I think he has to get his other Democrats to go along with him. Of course, he's an independent, but he votes with the Democrats.
Right, and a very good man, a man of the people. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, appreciate your time. Look forward to talking to you again tomorrow.
Thank you.
All righty, and now to find out what's going on. What do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Interesting article coming out of Harrisburg, Rick, concerning Governor Corbett's cuts on his budget. At school board meetings across Pennsylvania, the ramifications of Governor Tom Corbett's proposed public education budget cuts are sinking in. Has reality come to this? Frustrated parents and students are asking this question as they look at the state budget and watch school board members and administration weigh whether to cut back or eliminate teaching positions, eliminate after-school programs, elective classes, or in some cases, kindergarten. There is one legislative red flag that the General Assembly cannot ignore. The governor's proposed cuts will scratch some districts and impale others. Some districts will lose as little as $76 per student next year, according to an analyst by the Educational Law Center. At the other extreme, 37 school districts in the state, mostly urban and rural, will lose $1,000 or more per student. Let me repeat that. Some school districts, mostly urban, will lose as much as $1,000 or more per student. The governor's proposed educational cuts are hitting everywhere in our own region, even academically successful, while huge districts such as Camp Hill, Cumberland Valley, and Gary Township are facing cuts, having to weigh the tough decisions between slashing facilities and staff, on programs or raising taxes. But the cuts to those districts, Camp Hill would lose about $179 per student, Cumberland Valley would lose about $237, and Derry Township about $121, are in the Little League compared with Harrisburg and Steele High, which is looking at a $1,139 per student scale back. The General Assembly cannot allow the state's highest poverty districts to bear the brunt of the educational cuts. Some local school districts are looking at a big underfunding for each student. That is indeed troubling.
What the heck was that?
Don't worry about it.
What's that? No. I guess it's true. We are on a road to nowhere. You look at the budget and you go, we're absolutely going nowhere.
And
but that just came out of nowhere. It's like, oh, my God, we're being attacked.
Well, I mean, on a serious subject, look, Rich, you look Rick. You look at the districts around this area that are being slashed.
Yeah, I know, John.
And you're talking $1,139 per student. That's huge.
Look, you know,
in poor districts, we got some real severe problems. This governor needs, for the sake of all of us, forget about the partisan politics. When it comes to education, he really needs to get his act together.
We give out fundraising things, buy sandwiches and cookies and constantly hold bake sales. We can do this. Well, we can make up $1,000. Give the kid a box of, you know, like when I was a kid, going around with candles and all kind of Christmas paper, all kind of religious nonsense going around door to door in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland going, will you please buy some of this crap? The Catholic churches want me to hawk, please. Nobody ever bought anything. No, my neighbor was
bishop,
poor.
The bishop needed the money. Come on.
Yeah, well, he needed something, all right.
On a serious vein, the governor, boy, he's taking his budget proposals are taking it from all quarters. Apparently, the Chief Justice, Ronald Castillo, is not very happy with his proposals, with budget proposals as it pertains to the state court systems. He warned today, meaning Pennsylvania's Chief Justice warned today, that a frozen judicial branch budget will leave about $47 million deficit that could impact in a wide range of court services. Chief Justice Ronald Castillo's annual State of the Commonwealth Courts report said Pennsylvania's budget does not fund 70 current common pleas judges, 87 district justices, and 42 court administrators. He said about 83% of the judiciary's budget request would go to the personnel cost, about 13% to counties for court expenses, and about 4% for operating costs. Pennsylvania's judiciary does not create these serial structural deficits, and Pennsylvania judiciary cannot save its way out of them, according to Castillo. If we cannot pay judges and fund court operations, including our successful computerization efforts, those who depend on the judiciary for solutions of issues in civil family problem-solving courts may soon face this crisis as well. Governor Tom Corbett's spent proposals hold the court system budget at about $335 million, $47 million less than the current courts had requested. The state is facing a $4 billion deficit. The courts have left judgeships vacant. They have suspended merit pay and frozen salaries, imposed a targeted hiring freeze and out-of-state travel ban, and reduced the number of common pleas and district justices. Again, a situation where the governor has some real problems and some real dissatisfaction.
Yep. Anyway.
Think about it a little bit, ladies and gentlemen.
Think about it.
Think about it a little bit, ladies and gentlemen.
Think about it. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We're right back to wrap things up. Stick around.
Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The man who sends the investor class diving with their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
All righty, we got to talk about the important stuff now. Or at least my wife says the important stuff. The big wedding on, I guess it's Friday. Is that when this debacle goes off? Where these two nitwits who I could give a rat's behind about are going to get married in front of, you know, thousands of people who seem to adore them for some bizarre reason. And I guess it's just that I'm American and I don't get the whole royal wedding thing. Can you imagine if, Malia or Sasha were getting married? I mean, they're just kids right now, but can you imagine if they were 20s or if the Bush, and again, I can't say what I was thinking, but the Bush twins decided they were going to get married and they were going to charge the taxpayers a whole bunch of money to have a wedding. Do you know what kind of outrage would happen here? Same thing here. I mean, you look at how much this wedding is going to cost, and they're saying that estimates put the costs to the people of the UK, of Britain there, between $15 million and $68 million. $68 million. I'm going, really? Can't they just elope? Can't they just go away and, yeah, we did it. Here's the ring. The fact that her dress is going to cost $315,000. They're going to spend $800,000 on flowers. Really? $100,000 on a cake? Really? You couldn't go down to the local bakery and say, whip me something up?
This is world news. I mean, you might think I'm a little wacky, but, part of it to me, it's kind of majestic. I understand. If you're British, Rick, I think they still respect the monarchy. I think they respect the pageantry and the history. There's part of Great Britain that wants to get away from it, but I think there's part of them that still wants to hang on to that history.
No, evidently it's a craze there. Anything that they can slap these two people's name on, from vomit bags to some bizarre candy, they're being sold out of. The only thing that I think is kind of interesting is this Scottish brewing company. This company, BrewDog, maybe you saw this. They have come out with a special beer just for this occasion. A special beer just for the royal wedding, and they're calling it the Royal Virility Performance Beer. It's an India Pale Ale containing herbal Viagra, chocolate, goat weed, and a healthy dose of sarcasm. Evidently, there will only be 1,000 bottles made. They're going for close to $17 a bottle. But again, it's the Viagra beer, and it's being labeled with phrases like "Celebrate Big Willie style" and "Arise, Prince Willie." since the prince's name is William. So evidently they're going to give him some of this to help him during his honeymoon. So good for him. Personally, I think it's while people are starving, it is indecent. It is ridiculous. It's ludicrous. It's arrogant. It's elitist. It's just plain dumb. And if you're going to be the leader of that country, I would be the person saying, oh, hold on, back up. Let's have a nice little affair. Save some of that money. Those people need it.
Well, I mean, let's be honest, in Great Britain, they're pretty much ceremonial. There are some people who, for years, have been trying to limit the spending on the monarchy. You know, you might be among a lot of people with the same opinion, Great Britain.
And, oh, my God, that's all we're going to see for the next 6 months, commemorative plates, and, oh, you can get your limited special edition, one of 400 billion commemorative videotapes or embossed toilet paper from the big event. I mean, oh, come on. The capitalists are just going to go nuts with this, and I'm going to be stuck watching all of this stuff again and again and again. Oh. And, yes, it is about me. Anyway, Gabby Giffords is back in the news. She, I guess, doing better. She has raised during the January to March election, during the fundraising season there, over $350,000. And I guess all it takes is getting shot in the head to raise, you know, almost $500,000. Good for her. I hope she wins re-election. You know, kind of interesting. But again, you know, raised over $350,000. Didn't have to do much to do it, other than, of course, take a bullet in the head. You want to talk about indecent? Let's talk about indecent for a moment, shall we? Halliburton. Ah, yes, our favorite company, Halliburton. They have reported for the first quarter of 2011, a record revenue of $5.3 billion. $5.3 billion. Record revenues. And you do know part of their job is that they're the drilling people. And, you know, this kind of takes a shot at the right-wing talking points that Obama won't let anybody drill when their revenue is $5.3 billion. In fact, their CEO said that I'm extremely pleased with our quarter one results as overall revenue in the first quarter set a company record. He said that North America delivered strong performance as margins progressed due to increased activity. So where's all this Obama holding them back? It's not happening. In fact, their CEO, David Lesser, the chairman, president, and chief executive officer, again, which I think is just dumb, having the chairman, the president, and the CEO as the same guy. Totally a conflict of interest. But he said that he's confident that under Obama, domestic energy production opportunities will continue to grow. Now, despite record revenue and profit, despite lining their pockets, filling their coffers, we are still giving them subsidies. We are still going, you know what, thank you for moving offshore. Thank you. Thank you for going to the Cayman Islands and becoming a global corporation. And for that privilege, we're going to heap you with tax subsidies. Explain that to me, because I'm having a hard time with it, Jake. I'm having a hard time when I'm going to the gas pump and I'm paying close to $4 a gallon. And you look at that station in Washington, D.C., that's $5. When I'm struggling to put gas in my tank and there's some nitwit who's siphoning gas out of my driveway, who if I catch, I'm going to strangle. In the nicest of ways, of course. Yeah, I mean, there's some nitwit going around our neighborhood siphoning gas out of people's cars in their driveways. That's what it's come to. The price of gas has gone so high that now we're starting a criminal enterprise of a guy going around with a garden hose going, yep, I'll take a load in the mouth for a bucket of gas.
Well, I mean, you talk about Exxon, some of these energy companies. It makes sense, Rick. I mean, it really does when you have a burgeoning industry, when you have a young industry. It's just starting out. Maybe help a little jump start. But the immensely profitable, even almost almost, what's the word, obscene profits in some of these companies. They don't need government handouts, especially now.
Yep. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and